The Life Changer. Copyright Khadijat Abubakar Jali. Dedication. For my beloved children, Zara, Najwa, Basma, Sadiq, and Farha. The Life Changer, Chapter 1. They were waiting for Daddy. We were. I paused outside their door. The laughter was cheerful. It was also infectious. It began as a silent chuckle. Then slowly, it turned into a mirthful but stilted giggle. Now, it had finally transformed into a full-fledged chortle. I stopped a while to listen. My plan was not to eavesdrop. God forbid that I should be that kind of mother who surreptitiously listened on her children's private conversation. But there was something about the laughter that was compelling and arresting. Bint, my 5-year-old daughter, appeared to be the narrative voice. She was telling her 2 sisters the story of her classroom encounter with their meddlesome social studies teacher the previous week. The narration was so vivid, you could actually visualize what transpired. The teacher believed he knew a little bit about every subject under the sun, especially French, which most of the students found strange. Bint herself was new in the school. French was an optional subject, even at this level of primary school education. We, however, encouraged her to take the option, since we believed that language acquisition at an early age came relatively easy and with minimal effort. And in any case, French was second to English in the ranking of international languages we reckoned. So it was that the first question the teacher asked was, "Who can tell me how to say good morning in French?" Everybody was silent in the classroom. "You mean none of you knows how to say good morning in French?" Hesitatingly, not without trepidation, Bint raised her hand. "Yes," he pointed at her. Slowly she stood up. "What is your name?" the teacher asked. "My name is Bint." "So, tell us, Bint, how do you say good morning in French?"
"Bonjour," Bint said.
"That's very good," the teacher said, speaking English.
"And how do you say that's very good in French?" Bint asked innocently.
"What?" The teacher jerked his head off as if stung by a bee. Then within a flash, he bolted out of the classroom, only to come back a few minutes later with the French mistress of the senior classes. "Ask her," he told Bint simply.
"How do you say that's very good in French, auntie?" Bint asked reverentially.
"C'est très bien,"
the French mistress replied.
"C'est très bien,"
Bint replied confidently. The class began clapping and laughing at the same time. The class teacher followed the French mistress out and didn't come back till after the break. Meanwhile, the whole class as one surrounded Bint and started clapping and singing, going round her in cheer and joy. They seemed to have known instinctively that Bint was destined for bigger things. Who else but a genius will ask a question the teacher could not answer?
"I got them. I really got them," Bint was saying excitedly to her siblings. I found myself laughing silently. Before I got carried away, I let myself unobtrusively into the room. They were used to my impromptu barging. One reason I used to go in unannounced was to keep them on their toes where issues of personal hygiene were concerned. The second reason was that we were used to keeping each other company. These formed the rationale for my periodic check-in of their room to ensure that they learned the basic norms of maintaining the cleanliness of their room at an early age and to get used to my presence. My own grandmother used to tell us when we were young that what you teach a child is like writing on a rock, and when dried, it will be difficult to erase.
I seldom miss an opportunity to make them see the lesson in an experience. They learned to respect my opinion over most of their matters, and I tried not to be unnecessarily didactic when it came to correction or giving instructions. This cemented our mutual trust. "I am so proud of you, Bint," I said, as I wedged myself between Bint and Jamila, her immediate elder sister. They were all seated by the edge of the bed and looked up at me, as if my intrusion had all along been anticipated. "Thank you, Mommy," Bint said as she nestled even closer to me. She was my last child and consequently the darling of the entire family. My first child was Omar. He was the first child and only male. Between Omar and Bint, there is such great affinity that no one dared frown at her intransigence, no matter how great if he was around. And all of them called me Mommy. They didn't call me Mama, a title every child in my community used for their mother. They couldn't call me Umi, which was my name at home, which incidentally also meant Mommy. It actually translated to my mother in Arabic because I was named after my paternal grandmother. So I was Umi to everybody else and Mommy to my children and their friends. Except Omar, who insisted on calling me Mom. I was never particular about how I was addressed. What I always insisted was respect for each other and for one another. "Listen, young girls. All Malam Salihu was trying to do was to practice his small French, thereby trying to perfect it. You should give him a break. Moreover, he's humble enough to accept that he does not know. Another teacher will frown his face and tell you, 'Au revoir,' means welcome whether you like it or not. Your knowledge to the contrary will mean nothing to him. But au revoir means goodbye until we meet again, Mommy," Bint was quick to point out. "I know, my dear, but if the teacher is angry, he can tell you any word means whatever he wants it to mean. That will not be fair. It is also not fair to push your teachers beyond what they know. They are the ones who act as if they know everything, Mommy." When our conversation got that animated, my children seemed to forget that I was also a teacher. I never bothered reminding them. The spontaneity of the discussion was what made it interesting, and if you attempted to interrupt, you will destroy the flow of the discussion. Tima, my second child, opened her mouth to say something and paused. Just then, there was this loud knock on the door. Before he was asked to come in, Omar pushed open the door and jumped on me. "I made it, Mom! I made it!" His sisters all stood up as one and began asking, "What did you make?" "I made it to the university, dears. Bint, your big brother, is a university student." They screamed and shouted and ululated. The news came as a pleasant surprise to them, and especially to me. Nobody knew where Omar was going when he left home earlier that morning. To say the truth, he was looking rather anxious when he came to greet me in the morning. He was dressed in blue jeans and white shirt. His skin-cut hairstyle contrasted beautifully with his sideburns, which he kept clean and trim. He had always been a precocious child. To look at him, you would think he was well into his 20s. But Omar was just 18. My singular thrill with Omar was that he was always decently dressed and clean. This pleased me beyond measure. Now, I was even more pleased when he thrust his admission letter from Joint Admissions and Matriculation Board to me. The board was popularly known by its acronym, JAMB. Indeed, even at my time, it was not inconceivable that there were some undergraduate students who never knew what the acronym stood for, let alone now. Anyhow, I took the letter and read it. My son was given admission to study law at the Congo campus of Ahmadu Bello University, Zaria. This was exhilarating. This was all his father dreamt of. My husband had wanted to read law himself, but Providence dictated he read accounting. Big bros, what course did they give you? Tima, my first daughter, and therefore Omar's immediate younger sister, asked. Look here, young lady. Call me with respect. To you and everybody in this house, except Mom and Dad, of course, all of you should now call me my learned brother. In the school, we call each other my learned colleague. So, since you're not my colleagues, you call me my learned brother. Indeed. This is called running before learning to crawl, Tima laughed. Can you hear yourself? Jamila said to her brother. Just call yourself Omar Esquire, Tima said. Mom, your daughters are plain jealous. Indeed, Tima managed to muster all the affectionate sarcasm in that single word. Big bros, congratulations, Bin said, turning to her brother to give him a hug. Thank you, my dear. For you, there is an exception. Call me whatever you want. But those belligerent sisters of yours, let me just catch them calling my name anyhow. We'll take them to court. They all burst into laughter. Wow, I'm really so happy for you. Let your father come home. There will be a grand celebration today, I said, tactlessly. I knew my utterance was tactless because as soon as I said that, my face was besieged by 8 expectant ears, all wanting to know what I had in mind and how the celebration was going to be and when. First, let us wait for your father's return. He closes at 5 o'clock in the evening and arrives home later. You know that his is the only bank in this community. It's okay, Mom, but tell your children, especially that blabbermouth called Tima, that nobody should tell Dad about this admission before me, Omar said. Why is that? I asked. He promised to upgrade my touchlight phone to a smart Android phone. That's not true, Mom, Tima said. There's no way Daddy will promise him smartphone while he leaves us with this touchlight phone. Tima's protest elicited such laughter that for a moment I forgot what the bickering was about. Mom, you see plain jealousy, envy. That's what's stopping Tima from growing tall. I allowed them to chastise one another a while before ruling that whatever their father's decision will be, either on the celebration or on the purported phone purchase, will have to wait till the owner of the house arrived. All I asked is that nobody should rush to tell him beforehand. Omar repeated his request. Okay, I said. Nobody will be the one to tell him first. As soon as he arrives, you will go and tell him the good news yourself. Thank you, Mom. You're welcome, Omar. The room was getting stuffy because we did not turn on the fan. What was I saying? We did not have lights for 2 days now, and the generator was in need of repairs. Let's go outside and sit under the mango tree in the courtyard, Jamila said, wrenching the words out of my mouth. It is very hot in here. We trooped out and went to the courtyard. White plastic chairs were already there, and Bint and Jamila began dusting them with an old piece of clothing. Mommy. Yes, Bint, what is it? I want to drink Zobo. I can buy that for everybody, Omar said. Tima, bring 5 bottles of Zobo. Bring the money first. Omar turned to look balefully at me. You see, Mom, Tima does not even trust me. I just sat there smiling. When it comes to money, Omar, Tima said, do you trust yourself? I sure do. How many times did you take my Zobo without paying? That was different. I was not an undergraduate then. Now, you're talking to a potential lawyer. See, young girl, you'd better watch it. You could be in trouble one day, and your brother here will be called upon to defend you. I will remind you of this day, believe me. Tima, go and get the Zobo, I said. I will pay. Thank you, Mom. By this time, Bint and Jamila were done cleaning the chairs. We sat as close to each other as the white plastic chairs would allow, and waited for Tima to bring the zobo. There was a very joyous atmosphere in the air, and nobody wanted to spoil it. Then all of a sudden, Bin said, "Mommy, tell us a story." Before I could answer, Tima was back with 5 bottles of zobo on a plastic tray and squatted to serve us. That got me thinking. Bint wanted me to tell a story, but it was a different story that came to mind. Omar was going to a new environment. Until now, he had been ensconced in this Lafayette community of ours. He was going to town. The university was a civilized community, different from ours, and with so much freedom. One didn't know what to do with it. Maybe I should tell them about my experiences in the university. But how interesting could that be? My life before marriage had always been one dreary thing after another. That surely was not the kind of story someone like Bint, or the remaining children for that matter, would want to hear. It certainly was not the kind of story my exuberant son would like to hear. I decided not to bother about any story. Let the story, whatever its angle or angles, come naturally, or not at all. I knew, though, that since my marriage coincided with my entry into the university and so much drama was witnessed then, my children may have a peep into that life. Like I said, however, I will not make a deliberate effort at personal narration. We still had like 2 or 3 hours before their father returned from work. Me? The joy of a teacher was that as long as the school was over, she too was free to rest till the next day. I had time. I would ask Omar about his admission first. How did he go about getting it when no one raised a finger to help him? "You see, Mom," Omar told me, even as his siblings listened, "there is always a silver lining in the cloud. After I passed SSC examinations, by no means a small feat, even if I'm saying it." "What do you mean by that immodest remark? By no means a small feat. Well done, William Shakespeare." That was Tima, always looking for her brother's trouble, as they say. "Mom, tell this big mouth to stop interrupting a lawyer when he is speaking." Then he turned to address Tima herself. "Don't you know how many of my colleagues had their exams sat for? Don't you know how many parents paid big money to these so-called miracle centers where no candidate fails their exams? Don't you think I have a right to boast of my achievement when I scored 7 credits, including English and mathematics, at the very first attempt in my WAEC examination?" "It is by no means a small feat, my dear sister. Don't let me curse your efforts, you hear? Otherwise, I will say yours is soon coming, and I will see what you would make." Tima sensed Omar was slightly hurt. She stopped taunting him, and he went on with his story. "After the BIEC results were out, we purchased the JAMB form, filled it online, and submitted. While people were running helter-skelter from one school to another, looking for whom to assist them with their children's admission, I prayed that I should pass the matriculation exams well. I scored 230 out of 400. "We know that too, and we never slept the day the result was announced." That was from Jamila. Omar ignored her. "2 days ago, my friends called and advised me to check the admission online." He paused to look emphatically at me. I braced up, knowing what was coming. "Mom, you see why smartphones are important. Most of my friends knew of their admissions from the comfort of their bedrooms by simply browsing on their phones. Me, I had to wait 2 days. So let Daddy know that. Anyhow, it was worth the wait. I went to the internet cafe today to check on my admission status and found my name among the successful candidates. The experience was really thrilling. But it would have been better still if I just browsed and saw my name in the comfort of my room.
It's okay, my son, I said. We will see about that phone when Daddy comes back. Meanwhile, do you know the implication of this admission in your life?
Sure. It means I have arrived. It means I am at one with members of the intelligentsia.
I smiled at my son's naivety. Just an admission letter, and he had already become a member of the intelligentsia. The young, Listen, my son, this admission is a life changer for you. Life changer? Yes. What does that mean, Mom?
It means it changes your life, Tima said.
It means more than that, my dear. It means it also changes you.
How can it change me?
Well, I may not be able to categorically tell you how it can change you, but I know my admission changed me.
How, Mom?
The Life Changer, Chapter 2. It was a bright sunny day, and all the people of Lafayette were happy that their daughter, Umi, was going to the university. That was more than 20 years ago. My father agreed on the condition that I got married before I graduated. That was another story. My husband, your father, agreed we should marry even before I went for my registration. So, for me and members of the community, it was double celebration of sorts. I didn't know how right my husband was until I set foot into the university. The first thing that struck me was the carefree attitude of the people there. Everybody was going about their business without apparent care in the world. What was even more striking was that it was difficult to tell who was a student and who was a teacher. I mean, in my secondary school, we all had uniforms as students. Only the teachers were allowed to come in their private dresses.
Wait, Mom. You mean I will not be required to wear uniforms again?
Sadly, not for you, my learned friend. You people at the Faculty of Law have what they call dress code, which comprises black trousers, white shirts, and black neckties for boys and ditto for girls, except that in the place of trousers, the girls wear skirts. But even that is during classes only. It's not so bad after all.
No, it isn't.
And really, it makes you kind of stand out of the crowd. It makes you special in a sense.
Then what happened, Mommy? Jamila asked.
What happened where?
After you noticed that students and staff were not dressed differently.
My dear Jamila, I didn't say they were not dressed differently. I said the students were not required to wear uniforms. As for difference in dressing, that was one of the first things you would notice. And Omar, you'd better pay attention here. The way the girls in the university dress leaves very little to the imagination.
What does that mean, Bint asked.
It means they dress almost naked.
This is very serious, Mom. And the university allows that?
In my school, for just wearing the wrong color of sandals, you will be sent home.
Bint, your school is a primary school now. You can't compare it to the university.
I know Bint is wondering. Discipline and decency should be permanent aspects of human character. They should not be limited to a certain level or category of schooling, Omar said.
This interruption will not help us, children. I thought I was telling you about my reaction to this freedom of dressing when I first entered the university.
No more interference, please. Let me tell you guys our experience with Salma.
Salma was a fair-complexioned girl, tall, slim, and rather busty. That last was obvious to see, even to some of us who were recently married. The tight-fitting clothes she wore made you wonder how long it took her to wiggle herself into them. She had on very dark sunshades, which accentuated her formidable appearance. The young men around were openly ogling her, while the few of us ladies belonging to the school, even then, pretended not to notice her. We were at the faculty registration office. The lecturer in charge had taken ages to come. Indeed, he was taking eternity to start. No one entered the office after him, and we stood in the queue for like an hour without movement. This summer of a girl had come barely 15 minutes, and she was all over the place grumbling about the ineptitude of the registration officers, the so-called university lecturers. They are, all of them, inconsiderate, she declared. They're so heartless. It is hard to imagine they have children at home. She was last on the queue, but will not stay at her place. One young man addressed her politely and said, "Young lady, some of these people have been here for far longer than you have been and are patient enough to wait for the lecturer to get ready so they could all proceed to the next level of the registration exercise." "You don't know these people as I do," Salma said. "If you wait here, that is how they will keep you till dusk, doing nothing. They have nothing to do but to frustrate you. They're like the policeman at the checkpoint. If they stop you with unnecessary queries, it's not so much because they want bribe. This is a given. But sometimes they want to delay you as long as possible to keep them company till the next vehicle arrives. It can be so lonely manning the road as a policeman." "You mean there is no difference between your lecturers and the policemen on the road?" the young man asked. "They're all the same. In fact, you are better off with the policeman because at once you know where you are with him. Whether you are right or wrong, just grease his palms and he will allow you to pass. With lecturers, you don't even know where you stand. As a boy, they will ask you for money. As a girl, they will ask you for a date." "Just like that?" "What do you mean just like that?" "Of course. It is in return for a favor desired, like the monkey in this office, whoever he is. I mean, you cannot just leave people standing on the queue while you are inside doing nothing. So if I have the opportunity, I will just go in, give him 2,000 or 3,000 naira to pocket, and he will attend to me." "You are sure about that, my dear?" "Sure, but why are you asking me so many questions?" Salma removed her sunshades and looked intently at the young man interrogating her. "I just find your allegation a trifle sweeping. Too general, if you ask me. You don't know these lecturers as I do. This is not my first university, you know." "I can imagine," the man said. "Just now, you were saying, if we allow you to go in, you could influence the man to get the registration process started?" "Yes, please. Money moves mountains," Salma said. "I thought it was faith in the original." "Never mind," Salma said, putting her glasses back on. The man cleared his throat and addressed us. "Ladies and gentlemen, can we please allow this..." "What's your name?" He turned to Salma. "Salma Muhammad." "Ladies and gentlemen, can we please allow Salma Muhammad here to precede us to see the lecturer so that the registration can get started?" "Yes," we all answered in unison. Just then, the lecturer's door opened, and the man inside came out with a wet duster in his hand. He turned and locked the office. We all kept quiet, baffled. "The office is ready now, sir," the man said, turning to address no other person than the young man who had been engaging Salma in conversation. I did not understand what was happening at first. No one did. Meanwhile, Salma had removed her glasses for the second time and was looking at the young man strangely, speechlessly. Comprehension dawned on us almost at once. Everybody kept quiet. The man with the duster stretched out his hand and gave the young man the office key. "Thank you, John," the young man said. "Is there anything more you want me to do, sir?" "No, John. Just try to be faster with the cleaning job. It's not good to keep our new students waiting, you know." "I am sorry, sir. I am sorry, my dear students." John turned and hurriedly walked away from the scene. All eyes were now on the young lecturer who had all along been staying with us and was enduring what we were going through as his office was being cleaned. As for Salma, she just stood there, shivering like some rain-drenched chicken.
The man calmly walked by us, opened his office, and before he entered said, "Please be orderly. We will soon be done with the screening exercise. Maintain the first-come, first-served order. Thank you." He disappeared into the office. All eyes now turned to Salma. She was suddenly bereft of words. She was fidgeting and was busy looking at the design of her shoes all the remaining period till my turn came and I entered to be screened. Within a very short time, I was done and proceeded to the department for my matriculation number and other matters. I did not see Salma again till some few months into the semester. Wow, that was thrilling. Tima was beside herself with laughter. Just wait till I tell you what happened during my departmental registration. What happened, Mom? Omar asked. Not to know what transpired before I came to departmental office. The secretary was busy hitting away at her computer. She was visibly a woman of few words. She raised her head, assessed that I was a new student, and asked what she could do for me. I said I was there for my matric number. She just nodded towards the door beside her. On it was written, HOD. I knocked timidly at the door and waited. "Come in," came the rasp reply. I went in and was shocked to find that the HOD here was also a very young person. He sat resplendent behind his mighty desk and was scribbling away on some paper as I entered. He stopped writing and looked up. I saw at once that he had tribal marks which were rare in these times. They betrayed his ancestral origin. He was obviously an Igala person or Yoruba. I had no doubt about that. The crucifix dangling across his chest from the necklace he wore told me his religious inclination. I was instantly filled with apprehension without knowing why. "Yes, young lady, what can I do for you?" he asked. "I am a new student, sir. I came for my matric number." I was still standing. "Sit down, my dear." I sat down. "I know that I would always pass a test on etiquette. You are in a person's office. You never sit down, even if there are 100 other unoccupied seats, until you are invited to sit." For some reason, I found his endearing salutation slightly discomforting. "You do not just go about calling everybody your dear." Unless he meant something. I was immediately on my guard. The kind of things I heard Salma say about university lecturers filled me with foreboding. Of course, the young lecturer who talked to her was humble and nice. That ought to have dispelled my doubts. But it did not. I still had some reservations. The name pennon on his desk said simply, "Samuel Johnson, PhD. "You are among the first to report for registration," he said. "Yes, sir," I responded, wishing he would just assign me my number and get done with it. "What is your name?" he asked as he pulled a file towards himself. We were still analog then. But I do not think a lot of things have changed since my schooling days concerning record keeping, I mean. "My name is Umi Ahmed," I said. He nodded into his file, then casually asked me if I needed something to drink. "No, thank you, sir," I said rather too quickly. Suddenly, the office was becoming oppressive. I developed an instant, irrepressible feeling of claustrophobia. Why would your head of department offer you a drink just because you went for registration? This was how it got started. I decided to tell him I was married, but I quickly changed my mind. One thing I learnt in life is never to volunteer information unless specifically asked. "You look beautiful and decent in your attire," he said, as he stood up to come and sit on the sofa near the visitor's chair where I was seated. This was too much, I thought. Why would he be trying to make conversation with me when all I wanted was the matric number? Suddenly, the image of Salma loomed over my face. I could hear her saying, "All lecturers are the same. If you're a boy, they ask you for money. And if you're a girl, they ask you for a date." Surely,
This man will not be trying to make a pass at me. What was his business with my attire? I knew I was not wearing my hijab, but I was dressed in such a way that even those wearing the hijab will wish they were that covered. Of course, my entire face was exposed. I did not think there was anything wrong with that. Indeed, my husband and I had since come to the conclusion that a recalcitrant male will always misbehave, irrespective of what the woman wears. This put me on guard. Our students should emulate your style of dressing. I hope you are as intelligent upstairs as you are decent in appearance. You are better than I imagined. Something was wrong either with my hearing or with the man seated beside me on the sofa. He looked every inch responsible, yet I could not make head or tail of what he was blabbering about. All I wanted was to get out of that office. You are better than I imagined. What the hell was the meaning of that?
Sir, please, can I have my matric number now? I am pressed.
That last was a lie. I just wanted him to let me go. His response shocked me.
No problem, my dear. You can use my toilet.
No, sir, it is not allowed.
Who disallowed it? This is my office, remember? Unless, of course, if you were not pressed in the first place.
No, I was. I'm okay. Thank you, sir.
I was totally confused. I knew it was improper what I said, and now I was committed. He stood up and went and sat behind his desk, perchance to give me room to maneuver and enter the toilet. I mustered enough courage and entered the toilet. I came out a few moments later after flushing the toilet. It made a satisfactory, gurgling noise, which to my ear convinced the man that I must have discharged something. Still, the feeling was uncomfortable. Indeed, it was very embarrassing. I am not sure if I will be able to face the man again. He was buried in the file before him. I told myself that I had enough embarrassment for one day. With or without the number, I was leaving.
Here is your matric number, he said, as if reading my thought. You are UG0001. I pray, as you are the first here, you will be the first in everything.
For some reason, I was genuinely angry with this surreptitious overture.
Thank you, I said almost rudely, and made my way out of the office.
He still found it necessary to send his secretary after me to inform me that I had to proceed to the 100-level coordinator for further registration. I distinctly remember seeing him smile as I left his office. I was too angry to make anything of the smile at the time.
But why were you angry, Mummy? Bint asked curiously.
To tell you the truth, I really didn't know then. With the knowledge of hindsight now, I think I was angrier at myself than I was at him, because really, he didn't say or do anything rude that would warrant such reaction.
So, what happened after you saw the coordinator?
My registration went on smoothly from that moment on, and by the end of the day, that was around 4 o'clock in the evening, I was thoroughly exhausted. I took a tricycle home.
And what is a tricycle, Mummy?
Bint asked.
Keke napep, Tima replied her curtly.
Continue, Mummy. By the time I got home, your father was not yet back from the office. I hurriedly prepared his dinner, which he normally took early, and had my bath. When he returned, I waited for him to eat and rest, and I was about to start narrating the story of my first day in the university when he said,
"You just can't be too sure with people these days."
"Yes, dear, what happened?"
"It's a long story. It has to do with our neighbor."
"Which one of them?"
"The quiet one."
"The quiet one? That man cannot harm a fly."
"You never know with people, my dear."
Suddenly, that expression reminded me of my experience at the office of the HOD earlier. "Yes," I said. "You never know with people. Imagine what happened to me in school today." He seemed to suddenly remember.
I am sorry, sweetheart. What happened in the school? Please forgive me. I forgot to ask. I told him nothing much happened. Then I went ahead to narrate my registration experience that morning. From the long queue at the first registration point to the Salmar incident and down to the HOD's office, I left nothing out. Indeed, as I told him about the HOD, I supplied additional commentary on the incident. I did not bother hiding my anger. My husband was listening to me with a bemused expression on his face. I didn't quite understand his facial expression. "What is his name?" my husband asked. "I cannot really remember, dear. Why?" "Is it Dr. Samuel Johnson?" I was shocked. "Yes," I said simply. "Is his face scarified?" I looked blankly at him. "I mean, does he have tribal marks on his face?" "Yes, he has. It looks like an Igala or Yoruba man. Do you know him?" My husband doubled up in fits of laughter. He almost fell out of his chair. Then he got hold of himself and affected a seriousness which I knew he did not feel and looked almost pitifully at me. "He is Yoruba," he said. "That is Dr. Sam John, all right? He's my friend." I stared open-mouthed at my husband. He saw the surprise on my face and added, "Actually, he was the one who assisted me with your admission." The Life Changer, Chapter 3. There was a long, interminable silence in my narration. I could sense my children wanted to ask 1,001 questions, but each and every one of them was lost in their own thought. In fact, their silence reminded me of my own silence 20 years ago when my husband made that revelation. For a long while, I could not utter a single word. Then after what seemed like eternity, I sighed and told my husband to go to Dr. Sam John and personally apologize on my behalf. I could not see myself going back to the school to face my HOD after my inexcusable behavior. My husband understood my plight and agreed. The next week, when I chanced upon Dr. Sam John on the corridor, he greeted me jovially as if nothing ever happened. But then he was right. Nothing ever happened. It took a while for me to wrestle with my conscience and convince myself that indeed nothing happened and life went on as usual. "Mom, what about the quiet one?" Omar asked. "The quiet one? Oh, the story my husband told me about our neighbor." "Yes, Mommy, let's hear that one." All my girls seemed eager to hear that story. I stood up to let the blood circulate to my lower limbs, then resumed my seat and recounted to them the story of the quiet one as my husband told me. I looked at Omar in the face and told him that the tale I was about to tell would be more relevant to him since he was the one leaving our tiny community to a bigger city. He should not judge people on the face value. Never judge a book by its cover. And he must learn to trust sparingly. You do not just trust everybody you meet. I reminded them that in our little town, almost everyone knew everyone else. In Lafayette, the tradition had since been established that no stranger was hosted or given accommodation without the knowledge and approval of the district head, the Hakimi. The wisdom of this tradition was to ensure that no criminal or fugitive from justice was harbored or accommodated in the village. Our culture of neighborliness was superlative. This was contrary to what obtained in the town. In the town, everybody came and went as they pleased. Indeed, it was not inconceivable that two people living on the same street or even next-door neighbors could live for years without knowing who the other person was. In Lafayette, the story was different. Everybody knew everybody else. In the case of the quiet one, everybody knew when he was born, or more precisely, the circumstance of his birth. His parents were bona fide citizens of Lafayette, and they were known to be a very pious and humble couple. For several years after they were married, they did not have children, it appeared. So the elders said, when they were about giving up, they consulted the services of a formidable buka, a traditional medicine man, and their wishes were granted. People give different interpretations to what actually transpired.
While some believed that the boka gave them some potent concoction for instant fertility, others believed that he was indeed the one who fathered the child. In either case, Tali was the result. He was called Tali on account that shortly after his birth, his mother died. Thus, the secret of how he was fathered remained a secret. His father married another woman who also did not give birth to any child, so she helped in the upbringing of Tali. Tali was not called the quiet one at birth. It was his reticent nature while growing up that earned him the title. He was never known to have engaged in fisticuffs with anyone, even as a young lad. He withdrew him to himself, and this silent character stood him in a good stead whenever issues of responsibility arose in the community. He was barely 20 years old when he lost both his father and stepmother in a car accident. This compounded his state, and he withdrew further into himself. Tali was alone, literally alone. He had no one to consult or to speak to. No one knew what he did with his evenings and night. But from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the evening, he would go to work at the local government office where he served as a driver. At the office, he was always on the first row during prayers. He was so dedicated to his piety that people actually believed that there was something about him that indicated holiness. Tali never argued on any issues. He hardly disagreed with anyone, even if he was right. He never raised his voice on anyone. That was how he got the appellation of the quiet one. Then one day, just one day, things stopped being quiet for Tali. He had unwittingly established a pattern in his market purchases over the years, to the extent that the grocery stores he patronized knew at once what he was coming to buy. He thus became curious when suddenly the grocers discovered for over a week now, Tyler's requirement doubled. The people knew he was alone and could not possibly consume all the items he was buying all by himself. One of them thought it wise to call the attention of the district head. When Tali was summoned, he gave himself away by his very inability to answer the simple questions put forward by the Hakimi, the district head. The session began ordinarily but ended with a sad dramatic twist. "What did you buy in the market today, Tali?" the Hakimi asked.
"It was a few measures of rice and some palm oil." Tali was fidgety and seemed suddenly ill at ease.
"What precisely did you need a few measures of rice for? Your customer here said you used to buy just a measure, which lasts you a few days. The measure of garri you also used to buy suddenly doubled."
"Yes, Your Highness. But I just thought I should buy plenty so I would not suffer want in the event I have no money."
"So where do you get all the money to make these purchases now?"
Tali bowed his head and studiously looked at the ground. The posture of an archaeologist who suddenly had a gut feeling that something precious was hidden under the very ground he stood on. He stood there mute. The people were getting restless. They seemed to think as one that this was the moment when the silence of the quiet one was not a virtue. He had better speak. Just then, there was a loud commotion coming from outside the gate of the district head. There was a loud siren, as of a police vehicle, or that of a military escort, which came to stop outside the entrance of the Akimi's residence. In fact, it was not one, but three police vans that came to stop outside the gate. The villagers were first mesmerized by this rare forceful movement, and they became alarmed. It was an unholy sight, and given the speed with which they came and packed before the entrance of the Akimi's residence, the whole thing spelled something ominous. This had never happened in the history of Lafayette community. People thus searched to find out what was going on. On hearing the siren from outside, Tali sprang up and bolted into the Hakimi's house. The courtiers pursued him and brought him back. This act of attempting to run confirmed to the people that, if nothing else, Tally was guilty of something. But guilty of what? Nobody knew.
What's wrong with you, man? Why are you suddenly scared of a siren? One of the courtiers asked.
Before Tally could respond, three policemen, armed to the teeth, barged in on the Akimi and his courtiers.
Is this the palace of the Akimi in Lafayette?
One of the mean-looking policemen asked.
Yes, the Hakimi replied simply and ordered, I am the Hakimi.
We're looking for one of your subjects in connection with kidnapping, armed robbery, and extortion.
That is impossible, the Hakimi said. We're quiet and peace-loving people here. Our community has never apprehended even a common thief, let alone a kidnapper.
Well, well, we learned differently. The policeman turned to one of his colleagues and said, go and bring Zaki in here.
Zaki?
Everybody was shocked as Tally repeated the name. He swooned and fell. Those who observed at close range noticed that he actually urinated on his person.
Do you have a person named Tally in this village?
Ina lilai wa inahi lai rajiun, the courtier said.
We did not ask you for any supplication, the police officer said sarcastically.
That was more of a pious resignation to reality, the Hakimi said, and added, it means from Allah we came, and unto him is our returning.
Let your man spare me his Arabic lessons. Do you have a guy named Tally here, or don't you? And why is this guy sprawled on the floor? The policeman was impatience personified. He did not even give the Hakimi the respect strangers were supposed to accord him.
That is the Tally you are asking after, one of the courtiers volunteered.
Oh, in that case, our search is over.
The policeman now turned to the Hakimi and said, who can take us to his house?
He will do that himself. But what is all this about?
We told you that this man is an accessory to kidnapping and extortion.
Just then, the other policeman that was sent to bring Zaki came back, dragging and obviously battered Zaki, who was chained arms and legs. On the sight of the chained and manacled Zaki, Tally doubled over, and if that were possible, fainted a second time.
Get up, my friend! The policeman said curtly, brandishing a kick at Tally's middle.
Tally staggered up and immediately began declaring his innocence.
Believe me, officer, I am innocent, Tally said. It was Zaki's idea. He was the one who said they had a neighbor in town.
Shut up, my friend. Nobody asked you anything. Just take us to the house. Your house, the policeman growled.
The Hakimi was beside himself with confusion. He had never before witnessed anything like this. And he had been Hakimi in Lafayette for over 30 years. And come to think of it, if any act of misdeed were to be suspected in this humble village, Tally was the last person that would come to anybody's mind. Now it appeared, Tally was not only neck deep in whatever he was being accused, he was even trying to rationalize it. God, you really never know with men. Who would have thought?
But what was it really that they had done?
Excuse me, officer.
The Hakimi cleared his throat.
Yes, the policeman turned to the Hakimi.
Whatever it is that this man here would have done, it is expedient that you take a witness from here so that we can explain his absence to those who may wish to know something about his whereabouts.
Please yourself, Hakimi, but I can assure you that this man here will be absent for a very long time.
Who among you wants to follow them to town to report what is happening here? The Hakimi turned to his courtiers and other members of the community who had earlier trooped in to complain that Tally was observed buying more foodstuff than he was used to buying. They had observed the trend for almost 1 week before they decided to take action. The people cringed and turned their gaze away from the Hakimi.
Well then, the policeman said, since nobody is following us to town, we will adequately inform you through the Hakimi whatever happened later.
He then turned to Zaki.
Is this the Tally you told us about? He asked.
Zaki nodded. The policeman raised his baton.
Can't you talk?
Yes, yes, he's the one. That is Tally.
Okay, let's go.
Two other police constables dragged Tally up and whisked him out of the Hakimi's residence and into the waiting police van. As they drove slowly towards Tally's house, The people, hitherto reluctant to follow Tali to town, now willingly followed the police vehicles to Tali's house. Once there, the policemen followed Tali into the house and shortly thereafter came out with a young boy of no more than 13 years old. Tali was already handcuffed. He was hoisted into the waiting vehicle where Zaki was, and the boy sat in the front seat with a leading police officer who obviously was the IPO, the investigating police officer. The vehicle zoomed off and left Lafayette as hurriedly as they entered. That was the last anybody in the community saw of Tali. There was a rumor going on some years later that he was sighted in the border town up north where smuggling thrived. This rumor was, however, unconfirmed and it fizzled out as fast as it started. Of course, the Hakimi reported that the IPO sent a message detailing what happened in the Tali saga. Tali and his fellow conspirators were sentenced to some years of imprisonment with hard labor for kidnapping and extortion. The story the police told was intriguing in its simplicity. Tali was pressed for money, and he went to town on a weekend and he met Zaki. Zaki had a better idea. He told Tali that at the GRA, there was this businessman friend of his who would always be seen driving with his son in his car. If they could abduct the son, Zaki was sure the father would pay anything for ransom. Somehow, the boy was drugged and abducted, and in the middle of the night, they brought the boy to Tali's house in Lafayette and kept him for 1 week before the police came and freed the boy. The boy's father had been contacted and warned never to involve the police. The father reasoned that the kidnappers were amateurs since their asking price was 1 million and later came down to 250,000 naira. Zaki was arrested at the point of collecting the ransom. Wow, that is some story, Mom, Omar said. It appears to be a general admonition to all of us. Why do you say it is of particular interest to me? I smiled and said, my son, you are like that young boy in the story. You are going to the university. Do not trust anyone. Surely, Mom. I understand, of course, you will make friends and all that. Just be careful.
If he likes, let him trust everybody, Tima said. Mom, I'll...
Yes, I know what you will do. But whatever you will do, don't get mixed with bad company. Like kidnappers, Mom?
Nope.
Like cultists and those who engage in email.
Email?
Email. Exams malpractice.
Oh.
Oh. It was an acronym too.
It has many names.
Surely, I will avoid that. You remember Salma? Bint raised a hand as if attempting to answer a question in the classroom. Yes, my dear. Salma is that student who embarrassed herself during your registration, Bint declared. I was impressed.
Clap for my Bint!
The others clapped half-heartedly. Well, if you remember, by her confession, our school was not her first, I said. How did you know, Mom?
She told me. We later became friends. It was exams malpractice that drove her out of the university.
How? The Life Changer, Chapter 4. Salma casually walked into the office holding her registration files firmly across her chest. She was barely 20 years old then, and doubtless in the prime of her youth. She was endowed as a woman and was too willing to flaunt her elegance. She was always dressed in tight-fitting jeans trousers and body-hugs top that stopped just short of being indecent. Salma was a reckless dresser, and she was all too aware of the femininity she exuded and the effect this had on members of the opposite sex. She reveled in the hunger she saw in the eyes of men as they shamelessly ogled her body when she walked past them. This was called freedom, she thought. The university had a lot of this, and no one could reprimand you for daring to dress the way you wanted, so long as your attire stopped just this side of decency. Dr. Dabo was a highly disciplined lecturer, and he was never heard to engage in any form of underhandedness with any female student, or any student for that matter. Today, however, as Salma walked towards him with her registration files across her chest, he felt a lump rise in his throat. He had never seen a girl look so alluring and beautiful. He swallowed hard and chided himself not to disgrace himself. He must not put his reputation on the line. He had been in the university for more than a decade, and many students graduated in his hands. They all had singular respect for him. He ensured that he treated his students justly. He was a stickler for time. Consequently, he was always punctual to lectures. His rule was very simple. Don't come in after me. If he entered the class before you, you did not bother entering. The students knew this. In fact, his punctuality was phenomenal to the extent that the graduating students warned the incoming students beforehand that there was a no-nonsense lecturer who never allowed students into his class once he was there before them. As for consorting with the female students, God banished the thought. It had never happened. So when this fateful day, Salma walked into his office looking seductive and all, Dabo could not explain the sudden palpitation of his heart. The weather was cold outside, but he was sweating inside. "What was happening to me?" he asked himself. He cleared his throat and promised himself to dispose of her registration case as quickly as he could before he did something he would regret for the rest of his life. "What can I do for you?" he asked briskly. "I am 100 level students coming for registration. They said you are the level coordinator and that you are to sign my forms." Dabo marveled at the confidence of the girl. 100 level. And she was exuding such confidence. She must be a special breed. Almost sassy, he thought inwardly. Dabo's heart was still beating fast. "Yes, I am the level coordinator. Have you been screened?"
"Yes, sir. I was screened. It was from there that they directed me to your office."
"All right, then. Let's see if the forms are complete." She handed him the forms and he studied them carefully. They were complete. He signed the appropriate columns on the forms and reluctantly pushed the files to Salma. She hesitated before standing up and walking towards the door. It could have been her sheer beauty, her physical appearance, or some other inexplicable signal the devil had sent to Dabo's mind. Whatever it was, instead of allowing her to go, Dabo heard himself say, "Wait." She turned slowly and faced him. "Sit down, please. Just want to ask you a few questions." Surely that last sentence was not complete, but he wasn't bothered. "Where are you from?"
"I'm from the north."
"Is that a problem, sir?"
No, Dabo said and hesitated. It was not normal for him to be short of words, but he seemed suddenly tongue-tied today. The girl waited. "May I know you, please?" he said. Even to his ears, that sounded clumsy.
"I'm a student here, sir. I think that should be knowledge enough."
"I mean, I want to know you more intimately."
Salma instinctively knew all along that this was coming. Why he had to come from this sleazy-looking lecturer who had nothing to offer was what surprised her. Indeed, it made her angry. What kind of intimate nonsense was he talking about? University lecturer. From what she heard about the man, they said he was highly disciplined and serious. It was never in his character to have anything to do with his students, particularly the female students. So why her? And for God's sake, why now? Well, you never know with men.
"What do you mean more intimately?"
"Don't get me wrong. I simply mean I want us to be friends."
"It most certainly didn't come out like that."
"I know," he said. "So, can we be friends?"
"No, sir. With all due respect, that is not what my parents sent me here to do. In fact, you should be ashamed of yourself asking me out. You're old enough to be my father. So what kind of morality are you guys inculcating in your students when you cannot see a beautiful girl pass by without you making advances at her?"
Dabo was pinned beyond measure. He hated himself for his display of masculine weakness and hated her even more for reminding him of that weakness. But the fault was his.
"I am sorry," he said.
"You had better be," Salma hissed and added. "Even if the world is bereft of men, I will never go out with a man such as you." What kind of girl do you think I am? She stormed out of the office, leaving him in confusion. Dabo was in deep thought long after Salma had gone. What kind of trial was this, oh God? Something I have never done. What drove me into disgracing myself like this? For more than 10 years, I struggled and overcame this temptation. Now, such a small girl was sent to try us. What kind of life was this? Please, God, let this cup pass over me. Please, God, let her not talk. She was so cheeky, this girl. She could do almost anything. Luckily, Dabo thought, I did not do anything that will warrant a serious chastisement from the school authority. I didn't even ask her out, he told himself. He just said he wanted to be friends. What was wrong with that? Everything was wrong with that, an inner voice answered him. Then he remembered he used the word intimacy. Now, that one was serious. How do you defend yourself before a committee when they ask you to explain what you meant by wanting to know someone more intimately? God, please, let it never come to this. What kind of devil prompted me to let my guard low so? But the insult was painful. It was deep and painful, but he had it coming. If the bird chooses to fly in a cloudy weather, it should expect its flight to be cut by the rain. For a long time after Salma left, Dabo was lost in supplication. Please, God, clothe me in the garb of your holy prophets. Let not this mishap have impact on my life. If you guard me from this, Lord, I promise to be more dedicated and pious in the discharge of my duties and responsibilities as a moral custodian of our children here, now and in the future. Thank you, Lord, for answered prayers. On her own part, Salma did not even spare a thought to the fumbling old man who could not even articulate himself properly when trying to ask a girl out. He did not belong to her class. People with no confidence in themselves hardly fit the category of those she would consider her friends. So as she went out of Dabo's office, so did his thought go out of her head. She walked briskly to the hostel and concluded her accommodation registration. The registration for the hostel accommodation itself had its own problems. She discovered that she did not take to any of her three roommates in the beginning. There were four girls in the room. Salma herself from the north, Tomiwa from the west, specifically from Ibadan, Ngozi from Umunze in Imo State, and Ada from Benue State or Middle Belt, as she insisted people called her place of birth. In the beginning, Salma did not want to stay in the room. No, it wasn't because the hostel was not beautiful. It was the most coveted. It was the famous Queen Amina Hall. It was every female student's dream. It housed girls with savvy happening babes, as they called themselves, sophisticated ladies. It was not the hostel she did not like. It was the room. What Salma particularly did not like about the room she was allocated was the composition of her roommates. It was as if there was a deliberate design to offend every ounce of her accommodating sensibility. So, understandably, when her accommodation registration was done, she was wondering what accursed devil chose her roommates for her. She hated chance and happenstance, but she knew that no one deliberately worked out whom she should share her room with. The room allocation procedure was simple, really. The student was required to make the payment online and indicate their chosen hostel depending on availability and their chosen room. You just clicked the yes button on your chosen room, and the computer screen will show transaction completed if you secured a room, or transaction cancelled if the rooms were occupied. It followed then that the roommates were not any the wiser whom they had chosen by that simple click to be their roommates. Therefore, you were stuck with whoever you chose for the next 2 semesters at least. By the time she brought her things into the hostel and the school calendar resumed in earnest, Salma discovered that her roommates were not so disagreeable after all. Tomiwa was the brightest in the room and perhaps in her class. She was also the cleanest. Tomiwa's ambition was to become a singer, so she was always abreast with the latest information on the musical and the entertainment scene in general. She was in the know of the latest and craziest fashion outfit. Salma became close to her. Ngozi, on the other hand, was quiet and reticent. She appeared to have never left her village, spiritually speaking. She was always reserved and withdrawn, but she was also generous to a fault. She would never cook food just for herself alone. Whether her roommates ate or not, she would still invite them to come and join her while she was having dinner. Sometimes they would decline, other times they obliged her. When they saw that this attitude of sharing her food with them would not stop, they gave in and they started cooking as one small family. This cemented their relationship and they became their sisters' keepers. Sisters was the correct expression here. They were cooking in tents. The day it was Ada's turn to cook for the first time, Salma said she wanted to see all the ingredients she was going to use to make the Indomie jollof. This Indomie jollof was a sort of staple food among students, irrespective of sex or parental status. It was a noodles meal, prepared in such a way that within 10 minutes, it was ready for consumption. Because it was easy to prepare and cheap to acquire, it became students' favorite. "There is nothing special that we are using," Ada said. "You don't understand," Salma said. "We don't want to find a leg of rat in our indomie." All of them laughed it off, and Ada knew that Salma was teasing her, as rat is her people's delicacy. It was their loss, she said. Tomiwa, on the other hand, asked if they would like her village food for the kings. "What is that?" "Snail." "Snail? You mean you people eat snails?" "It's not the kind of infantry snail you see up north. In the west, they grow real big, and they're a special delicacy. We actually farm them." Ngozi said, "We eat snails where I come from, too." "Well, in this room, no one eats snail. But we can do it this way. Any day any one of you misses home and she feels like eating mama's food, you can warn us in advance so we will make our own arrangements for feeding that day." They all agreed to this. As God will have it, and as time went on, the only thing they as a group did not gang up to eat was rats, which in any case was never readily available in the school. As for the snail, they all indulged in its delicacy whenever Tomiwa's parents came visiting. Again, that was also not frequent because she was from Oyo State, more than 8 hours' drive from the Ahmadu Bello University, Zaria. Salma, on her own, only introduced them to Danwake delicacy, which was delicious and also easy to prepare. It was a special delicacy of the Hausa uplanders. All you need is flour, the normal flour they use for bread, be it from wheat or maize. Mash it into a paste using ground baobab leaves to mix. Then you drop it into the boiling water in small balls where it will harden, and a few minutes later, it was ready for eating. You could use either groundnut oil or stew to eat Danwake with. It sounded strange and looked even stranger to the eyes of her roommates. But the day Salma prepared the dish, they knew that sometimes there was no proportional relationship between what the eyes saw and what the mouth tasted. That northern delicacy was delicious. Food was therefore the common factor that strengthened the bond of friendship between Salma and her friends. In spite of their diversity, they came to discover that there was more in their humanity that held them together than those things that pulled them apart. Salma and Tomiwa were Muslims, while Ada and Ngozi were Christians. But this was never an issue. They did everything as one. Of course, there was the funny incident that happened that almost separated the intimacy Salma shared with Tomiwa. But on the intervention of Ada and Ngozi, it was resolved amicably. Salma was coming back from home one evening. It was actually late in the evening. It was around 8 o'clock in the evening. There were no vehicles. A black Mercedes-Benz car slid to the sidewalk where Salma was standing and stopped. Salma did not budge from where she was standing. The driver engaged the reverse gear and came to stop just beside Salma. He pressed the control button and the passenger window slid down. "Are you going our way, beautiful?" Salma saw that there were two men in the car and she was not comfortable. It had nothing to do with their dressing. They looked decent and affluent. Indeed, if they had not stopped to offer her a ride, she would have said they were almost responsible. Still, she was not very comfortable. If it was just one man in the car, maybe, just maybe. But this one, that there were two of them, well, thankfully, the distance from here to the school was not far. They could not try anything. She had nothing to lose. She shrugged. I said, "Are you going our way, princess?" When there are two men in a car and one appears too voluble, you can rest assured of two things. Either he's the one who has the car or he is the one who is interested in you. They would have discussed that before they stopped. Salma did not answer. She just opened the door behind the passenger seat and entered. She closed the door gently behind her. "Good evening, gentlemen," she said. "I do not know where you are going, but this is Kwangila, and I'm going to my school, Ahmadu Bello University, Zaria." "Then it is our way you are going. My name is Labaran," the man behind the wheel said as he changed gear to drive and move on. "You have not told us your name. I will tell you when I am getting off." About 10 minutes later, the car stopped at the main gate of Ahmadu Bello University. "Or would you prefer we take you right in?" "Sure. If you do not mind, that is." "Habib, what do you think?" "By all means, let's take her in." Habib appeared to be less voluble than Labaran, and Salma instantly decided if any of them was the owner of that car, it must be Habib. Not that she was particularly thrilled by the prospect of being asked out by Ben's owner, but it will certainly be a story worth telling that a certain big man in a big Mercedes-Benz had asked her out and she declined. That will make additional name in the entries of the influential people she had consciously turned down. So now, it was immaterial who asked her out. She knew she would say no. To hell with their flashy and expensive car. What kind of girl were they thinking she was? You just gave someone a ride and you were looking for a relationship that will last eternity. Big deal. The Benz pulled to a stop outside Queen Amina Hall, but none of the male occupants attempted to step out and open the door for Salma. This bravado stupidity, actually, that exemplified who the gentleman was in Europe and had no place in Africa. How can a lady whose limbs are in perfect working condition wait for someone to step out of a car, come round to open the door for her before she steps out? The whole thing smacks of waste of time. In any case, Salma was not expecting them to open the door for her. She was actually in a hurry to get out and meet her roommates. "You promised to tell us your name before alighting." Habib's tone was calm and gentle. "My name is Tomiwa," Salma heard herself say. "I am pleased to meet you. My name is Habib." "It's okay. May I have your number?" Again, without hesitation, Salma called out Tomiwa's number offhand. "You're too fast," Habib said. "Call the number again." She did, and Habib saved the number on his phone. He attempted calling, but there was no response. "It is telling me the line is switched off. I left the phone in the hostel. Maybe the battery has run down." "Okay. We will be here tomorrow at about this time. Will you be in?" "Yes," Salma replied curtly as she stepped out of the car. She heaved a big sigh of relief when the call to Tomiwa's did not go through. It wouldn't have been a nice experience. She needed a little time to warn Tomiwa on what to say if the strange man insisted on coming tomorrow. Let them. It was none of her business. They had fuel to burn and time to waste. And come to think of it, they were all old enough to be her fathers. The men had no shame. Men had no shame. Or maybe it was us girls who were irresponsible. "Good night, Tommy." Habib was waving his hand as she walked past the car into the hostel. She waved and disappeared into the hostel. As soon as she sat by the edge of the bed, which incidentally was where Tomiwa was sitting, she began narrating her story. Their room was a compact affair like most rooms in Amina Hall. The rooms were originally designed to accommodate just 2 students per room, but with student population explosion, the allocation was now officially 4 to a room. The school authority had changed the beds into double bunks that would adequately take care of the 4 people. Luckily in this room, perhaps because they were all new students, they didn't have what they called squatters. Usually, these were less privileged students who were not able to secure accommodation for themselves but will pay half the money for a room and be allowed to squat. This means that they will stay in the room but will have no privileges except sleeping rights. Only sleeping rights. As you entered the room, Salma and Tomiwa's bed was on the right, while Ngozi and Ada's double bunk was on the left. In between, you had the two reading tables at the end of the wall facing the window. Waka about, where have you been? Tomiwa had asked Salma by way of welcome. Where you sent me Odudua Pekin? Salma said. Tomiwa laughed a gentle laugh and let the remark pass. She knew that if she retaliated and called Salma Bayanjida Pekin, which was their standard joke, a long argument will ensue, and no one will know the end of it. History had it that the Yoruba people were all descendants of Odudua, while the Hausa people take their lineage from the Bayanjida. Both mythical figures claim their origin from the Middle East. Whether the legend was true or not, it was left for the historians to confirm. But for these students of ours, the myth provided an inexhaustible source of banter and ancestral pokes. I got a boyfriend for you, Salma said without preamble. What? Boyfriend? Did I tell you I need male company in this university? The male students here cannot even take care of themselves, let alone a girlfriend. Tomiwa didn't know whether Salma was serious or joking. For certain, though, this was the first time she broached such a topic. Calm down, my friend. At least ask me the kind of person I have for you before you go on chastising our poor male students. If they were to hear you, I swear they will skin you alive. Let them come and try. Anyway, tell me what happened. Some guys gave me a ride from Kwangila to the school. Eh? So what is new about that? How does that translate into me having a boyfriend? My God, you are the kind of woman who will get her tongue scalded due to frequent tasting of the undone stew. You simply do not have patience. Okay, Aristotle, I'm now ready for the quotation. Patience is a virtue. Possess it if you can. It is seldom found in a woman, but never in a man. Who the hell said that anyway? You just did, Salma said. Obviously, she does not want to be digressed. These two buffoons gave me a ride. And less than 15 minutes later, they were asking for my number. I fail to see what is strange there. If you liked them, you gave them the number. If you didn't, you gave them wrong number. I didn't neither. What do you mean? I gave them your number. Tomiwa stared at Salma with the eyes you would look at a fly that just landed in your soup. I should kill you for this, she said through constricted voice. I know, Salma said unruffled. I also know that you are the only one who is single in this room. Did I ever give a hint that there is a lacuna in my cup of happiness which I need men to fill? No. So why? Please don't make a mountain out of a molehill. You made the molehill out of nothing in the first place. See, these guys are not even sure they will come tomorrow. They attempted calling you, but luckily your line was switched off. I was charging the phone then, Tomiwa said. Well, it's really that simple. If they called tomorrow, you're free to answer or reject the call. They will be here around 8 o'clock in the evening. I see. Tomiwa did not see anything. If, on the other hand, your curiosity gets the better of you, you can go out for the adventure. Go and pretend to be me the way I pretended to be you. It should be an interesting experience. I do not know anything about that. Don't worry yourself. Let tomorrow come first. So tell me, what were they like? Stingy for sure. One is called Labaran. The other is Habib. It was Habib who collected my number. You cannot miss him. He talks very little. The owner of the car is Labaran. That one is overconfident, really. He's so damn sure of himself. I dislike him already. Just wait for tomorrow. All right. As they paused, suddenly the door opened and Ngozi and Ada walked in. Can you hear what Salma did? What did she do? They asked in unison. Tell them, Salma. Tell them. I just got Tomiwa here, a boyfriend, Salma said matter-of-factly. They laughed, but it was true in a sense, for this was how it happened. The Life Changer, Chapter 5. By 8 o'clock in the evening the next day, Tomiwa's phone rang. She jumped at the first ring as if she was not expecting it. The truth was that she had been waiting for that call all through the day. She had never been on a blind date before, and she never knew how she was expected to behave. The whole thing sounded crazy, but she was curious. In spite of her apparent social exposure and her confidence, which was born out of her desire to become a celebrity, Tomiwa was emotionally empty. She was beautiful, no doubt about it. Indeed, she could beat Salma in a contest, except that she was dark where Salma was fair. Otherwise, they were slim, busty, and definitely attractive. So, how was it that no boy ever attempted to go out with Tomiwa? The answer could be summed up in one word, overconfidence. She exuded such charismatic air around her that people, both males and females alike, rated her far above her station, which station nobody knew. Consequently, all of them felt intimidated in her presence, and she was an expensive dresser. It was not that the materials she sewed were out of this world. It was the style that was definitely out of this world. Her phone rang again for the second time. "Hello," she said, turning on the speaker so that her roommates, all three of them, could hear what was being said. "Is this Tomiwa?" "Yes. Who's speaking, please?" She looked up at her roommates and they gave her the thumbs up sign, indicating that she was doing well. "My name is Habib. We gave you a ride yesterday from Kwangila." Tomiwa paused, unsure whether to go ahead with a lie or tell the truth and forget the whole thing. "Hello?" The voice at the other end was hesitant. "Are you still there?" "Yes, I am." "Can you come out, please?" "Okay, where are you?" "We're packed where we dropped you yesterday." Yes, okay, I will be with you." There was silence at the other end. "Go, my friend, they won't eat you. If I know men, they may not even know the difference between you and me." Salma was very confident. Tomiwa, on the other hand, was hesitant. Indeed, she started developing cold feet about the whole thing. What if they turned out to be kidnappers or cultists? Who will come to her rescue if she entered a car with total strangers? Who formed the habit of visiting girls in the hostel only when it was night time? These thoughts were passing through her mind, even as she picked her handbag and casually walked out of the room to meet her unknown visitors. She saw the black Mercedes-Benz parked directly in front of the hostel. The passenger side was so empty she went and entered the car without prompting. It was strange. There were supposed to be two people in the car. "Where is your friend?" "Oh, my beauty, I am here," Labaran said from the back seat. "I made space for you in front so you can sit near your hearthrob." Far from being reassuring, this unexpected utterance and seating arrangements made Tomiwa even more uncomfortable. She had read so many thriller stories, particularly Mario Puzo's Godfather, and she knew how enemies were easily garroted when they are made to sit in the passenger side, while unbeknownst to them, the killers were seated directly behind them in the car. She did not let her fear show. Instead, she just opened the front seat, stepped out of the car, and asked Labaran to come to the front seat. Meekly, he obeyed. As she entered the back seat, Habib took a long look at her and seemed to be convinced that there was something wrong about the lady who just entered their car. She was more resolute and a trifle more confident than the girl of the previous night. But he told himself he will wait and see. There was a game plan somewhere and he did not want to spoil it. "Shall we move from here? It is rather too open. Where are we going?" "To a restaurant. I'm not hungry." Tomiwa was really ill-disposed with the whole setup. She felt the stab of Habib's long stare as she entered the car and she knew the man was not dumb, even before he said anything. "Let's go to Frizzle's then," Habib said this as he maneuvered the car to face where it came from so they could drive quietly to the fast food restaurant, which was surrounded by many grocery shops within the school. He parked the car near the shop of a man who proclaimed his shop the Faculty of Suya. This meant that his shop was the best place where steaks are made and sold. As they packed, Habib asked Labaran to go out and get them fried rice, chicken, milk, tea, beverages, sugar, and any other thing that he considered important to a boarding student. "Yes, Honorable." He went out of the car without collecting money from Habib. This, Tomiwa noted as strange, but she also knew instantly that authority had been established. She knew now who was the boss. Salma was wrong. Labaran may own the car, but he most certainly was not the one calling the shots. Habib was, and he appeared very perceptive. Tomiwa instinctively knew that Habib was not the kind of person you trifled with. "You are not Tomiwa," Habib said this categorically when Labaran was out of earshot. For some reason, the statement made Tomiwa angry. "Look here, Mr. Honorable, I do not care who you think you are, but you cannot just wake up this evening and declare my name fake. That is very insulting. If you had said, 'Hey, you're not the girl I picked yesterday,' I would gladly say yes, I was not. Since you're an expert at picking girls by the roadside, my name is Tomiwa, and I am not the girl you gave ride to yesterday." She added this last to soften the venom she knew her words must have caused. I'm sorry, my dear. I didn't mean to sound like that. And believe me, picking girls is not my habit. As you can see, it was Laborant's idea. He's my driver. I do not have any issue with you or your driver. I will not insult you for anything if you do not look down on me. I said I am sorry. Okay, just so long as we understand each other. I think I like you already. She didn't say anything to this. So tell me, what happened? Nothing happened. My friend didn't feel like giving you her number, so she gave you mine instead. I was supposed to reject your call or tell you wrong number, but my curiosity got the better part of me. I decided to come and see who it was that had my number. And we're here. I just declared that I liked you. I heard you. And what are you saying to that? Nothing. Why? Because I do not go about declaring likeness or otherwise to people whose faces I can hardly recognize in the daytime. Fine. That means you want to see me tomorrow in the afternoon. Yes. Is that why you told my driver to come to the front seat? No. I just didn't want to take chances. What if he sprang on me and strangled me from behind? You have a very wild imagination. Thank you. There was another long silence. If we have nothing left to say to each other, I guess I should be going in, Tomiwa said. You didn't even ask me who I am. Your friend, or is it your driver, has said who you are. Indeed, I'm not sure if I like politicians. Tomiwa was in her element. She never gave a thought to what she was saying. If it went down well with her listeners, fine. If it did not, also, fine. Why don't you like politicians? Habibu asked. They are like a spindle. Nobody knows the direction they are facing. They lie a lot. A lot of misguided people think the politicians are the solutions to our problems. Are they not? On the contrary, they are the problem. And on a personal level, I do not judge a person based on his affiliations. You don't? No. I get to know who you are and judge you as such. So, there is hope for me after all. Hope for what? For becoming your friend. I wouldn't be sitting in your car if there wasn't. Habib was so elated, he laughed out loud. How many of you are in the room? Four. Why? You take this. He handed over to her a bundle of 500 naira bills. She collected the money slowly and placed it on her laps. Put it in your bag. I do not want Labaran to see it. He won't. 10,000 for each of your roommates and 20,000 for you. Thank you. We really appreciate this gesture. Just then, Habib's phone rang. Yes, Labaran. I am done with the purchases. Then bring them over. Okay, honorable. Labaran came with so much provisions and beverages that Tomiwa thought they were buying things for their children in the boarding school. But no, Habib said it was for her and her roommates. Tomiwa was gratitude personified. She thanked Habib profusely and did not know when she started calling him Alaji. Habib too was very happy. He drove her to the entrance and promised to call her regularly. As soon as Tomiwa entered the room, they started shouting and ululating. The shout turned into a scream of joy when they saw what she brought. It was Ngozi who had the presence of mind to stand up and lock the door. This simple act is one of the most valued rituals of students who cook in the hostel. It effectively blocks out all those professional hangers who go about with spoon in their purses, looking for the pot that had just been brought down from the stove. Before you start eating, you lock the door. And if it was night, you switched off the light. If they knocked, you ignore. When Ngozi came back from the door, they opened the bags and saw what was almost beyond belief, even if they had come to school with nothing. What the Alaji had bought for them would have lasted them through another semester. They jumped some more and were embracing Tomiwa and thanking her. When the excitement died down, Salma said, "You guys should be thanking me. It was I who brought this matter here, you know. But if we had followed your counsel, we'll all be without these. It is Tomiwa we should thank. It is her boyfriend who supplied all these." Somehow, Salma was not happy with the turn of events. "Stop disgracing yourselves like this, my friends. Is it suya that you have not seen, or chicken or beverages, or these?" Tomiwa said dramatically as she dropped the bundle of 50,000 naira before them. They were all stunned. For one brief moment, there was total silence in the room. Tomiwa severed the moment and used it to divide the money the way she was instructed. 10,000 naira for each occupant, and she held on to the remaining 20,000. This was all too much for Salma. In the silence that followed, she was heard to have whispered, "It is not fair. It is not fair. Finders, keepers. It was me they gave right to. Tomiwa, you're not a good friend at all. I just showed you a guy and you went ahead to make him your boyfriend. You behave like a chameleon and can therefore adapt to any situation to meet your personal desires." "This is not a fair comment, Salma," Ngozi said. "You shut up there, money monger. All this one that you're standing for, Tomiwa, is it not for the money she brought? We have been in this room for how long now? Yet we have never seen you display so much love and camaraderie towards Tomiwa as you are doing this evening. If not the money, what else is accounting for this sudden friendliness? You do not even have shame, all of you."
"Salma, you do not have to be this aggressive, you know." Ada tried to be conciliatory.
"You two, shut up. How are you different from them all?"
"It is not about being different. It is about being rational." All this while, Ngozi had been fuming silently. She knew what Salma said was unreasonable. Was there any man on earth who did not like money?
"Ada, allow Salma to finish disgracing herself and displaying her foolishness. Who else but a daft person will see money by the wayside, and instead of picking it, he will show someone else the money to pick. Yet, when that person picks the money, he will start raining abuses on the person. Who else?" Ngozi hissed.
Ada was suddenly concerned. "Please, let this matter not degenerate into something else. We have been living in peace all this while. I do not see why these sentiments should be raising their heads in our midst. I thought the essence of education was for us to live as one and seek out what unites us rather than what separates us." Salma was heaving like someone who was about to have an asthmatic seizure. She could not see anything. She just stood there glaring at one roommate after another. Suddenly, there came a knock on the door. All those speaking kept quiet. There was complete silence in the room. They did not say anything, neither did they move. The person outside knocked some more. The roommates refused to budge. They looked alarmingly at each other, as if chiding themselves that because of their attitude, another party was coming to partake in the harvest of a farm produce they never lifted their hands in farming. When they heard the footsteps of the knocker receding, they sat down quietly around the roasted meat and chicken Tomiwa came in with. At a signal from Salma, Ada went and switched off the light in the room. Thereafter, they used lights from the inbuilt torch on their phones to see what they were eating. It was strange to see this total cooperation among the people who a few seconds before were at each other's throats. The herd instinct was indeed real, a situation which no entreaty could settle. Was suddenly resolved by a single knock on the door. They ate silently and for a long time. They discovered that they could not finish the meat and the chicken, so Ada was instructed to keep what was left in her fridge so they could use it the next day while cooking their meals. When the room was cleared, Ngozi switched on the light after unlocking the door. She told the other girls there was no point for them to harbor any ill feelings over what had transpired. If truth be told, didn't they all enjoy themselves as a result of the recklessness of some silly old men who could not resist dropping their purse at the sight of a bra? That is hardly the way to show gratitude to people who just fed us without asking for anything in return, Tomiwa said this lightheartedly. Ngozi, however, read something serious underlying the statement. "My sister, just mark my words. No man spends this much money on you without asking for something in return. Just wait and see. Men are all stupid, you know. Sooner or later, they will ask for their pound of flesh. This was just the first day and see what he spent." That was precisely Tomiwa's thought. It was just the first day and see how much she gained. If this went on, she had nothing to say to Salma but gratitude. "Let Ngozi talk on about the pound of flesh. I will give them 50 pounds of flesh if they asked. How much were they getting from Ngozi's stupid campus boyfriends? They gave nothing, and yet they kept asking for pounds of flesh. Make I hear what, Jerry?" As these thoughts were passing through Tomiwa's mind, she did not hear what the other girls were saying for a while. Then Salma asked a very strange question. "When did they say they are coming again?"
"Who?"
"Labaran and Habib," Salma said, looking very serious.
"Are you kidding me, Salma? What the hell comes over you?
You won't understand. Are they not true?" The others burst out laughing. It was indeed amusing what Salma was attempting to do. It appeared desperate, but under the circumstances, who would blame her? just one evening outing and you came out with over 10,000 naira, it would require a highly disciplined heart not to give in to such temptations. And Salma's heart was anything but disciplined. What, however, she will not take was to be forced to do anything she did not want to do. In consequence, she resolved to go out with the labaran, who to her dismay really turned out to be Habib's driver. The strange thing about the Honorable and his driver was that they grew up together, and while Habib went to read up to university level, labaran went to a driving school, and sometimes with his meager earnings as local government driver, he doled out a little from his money to his friend. So when Habib became a politician and was elected into the State House of Assembly, he called upon his childhood friend to be his driver, paid of course by the house. What was interesting, however, was that along this incongruous journey of life, their friendship never suffered any setback. And that was how they met Salma that fateful evening. Anyhow, that was how it went. The problems created by Tomiwa's visitors were soon forgotten by our sisterly roommates and life went on as usual. Indeed, those problems turned out to be a blessing in disguise. The roommates became more united than they were before. School routine resumed in earnest and soon the session was over. Before they knew it, they were in their final year. The last exam's timetable was out. Our four roommates held the record for being the only people who began as roommates and ended as roommates through to their last semester in the school. What was even more remarkable was that though they were reading different courses, they were all performing very well. They were all B students and were certain to graduate with a second-class upper degree in their various disciplines. They were the envy of almost every girl in the school. They never allowed their relationships with men to interfere with their academic performance. They were so fixated with graduating with a very good degree that they swore nothing will stand between them and the actualization of that dream. So it was that when exams came, they read like their lives depended on it. This went on successfully. Most of the papers were almost a walkover, and even though they were studying different disciplines, they were sure of making excellent grades. In any case, with the semester system, the students virtually knew what class of degree they were likely going to graduate with from their cumulative grade point average, CGPA. The genuine apprehension and excitement came when you were writing the last paper. Incidentally, the last paper this year was Moral Philosophy, which all of them were required to sit for because it was a general studies paper. I paused in my story when I noticed Bint whispering into Omar's ear. He laughed silently and whispered back. I looked at him, my face questioning. He stifled a laugh and said Bint was telling him she did not see how Salma's relationship with men or her roommates contributed to her leaving the school. I smiled and said, "My daughter, just be patient. We're almost coming there, and that is why I want you to pay attention. Jamila, my zobo is finished. Get me some more." The Life Changer, Chapter 6. I took a sip of my zobo and continued with the tale. Tima was hardly moving. Indeed, she was hardly breathing. That was how much she loved stories. I looked directly at her and reminded her that moral philosophy was usually one of the easiest subjects in the university, and it was also a general studies course, taken to the end of the examination timetable. In the case of Salma and her mates, it was the very last paper. It was considered easy because the course content involved all those things that their parents had been telling them since they were children. This, plus what their imams taught them in the mosque or their pastors preached to them in the church. Moral philosophy was sure going to be a walkover. Maybe that was why the school authority took it to the last part of the timetable, to kind of pacify the student, if you will. Surprisingly, it was also this same moral philosophy that Salma found very difficult. She never attended the classes because she believed, as most students did, that they could pass even without going to class. What further guaranteed her passing the course was that for 3 years going, the lecturer had been foolishly recycling the same questions with very minor modifications. This year, they resolved to tackle the subject head-on and had series of tutorial discussions concerning all the topics. Indeed, they were so well prepared that they knew the answers of virtually all the past questions offhand. On the day of the examination, Salma came out more stunning than all other days and looking ravishing and decidedly more beautiful. Her roommates had asked her what the occasion was. She told them that her course mates had planned on final class pictures to be shot with most of the lecturers after the paper, and she wanted to come out looking her best. She picked her examinations card and went,
as the law required.
30 minutes before the examination time, they were all searched and allowed into the examination hall. As soon as the question papers were distributed, Salma knew she was in deep trouble. It was strange. It was not true. It was unbelievable. It was impossible. None of the topics for which they spent the whole night preparing had come out. She looked around and was further dismayed to see her other classmates furiously writing on the answer script. It was as if they had all along been prepared
for the eventuality of that happening.
They must have read beyond the questions they practiced. The guy next to her, Kolawole Abdul, famed to be the brightest, was downloading pages upon pages of information from his head to the answer script. Salma, on the other hand, could not write anything. She kept looking from the invigilator to her paper and helplessly to Kola. The invigilator was female, and she made a studious note of avoiding eye contact with Salma. Unknown to Salma, she was the only one not writing. Consequently, she arrested the attention of the lecturer. Her outrageous dressing did nothing to endear her to the heart of the teacher. On the contrary, the teacher felt silently intimidated by the ostentatious appearance of Salma. She took an instant dislike in Salma, but she did not show it. As time wore on, Salma was able to use the student magic on Kola. The student magic was a trick students developed of speaking to the next person without moving their lips. The strangest thing was that the person spoken to could hear, or more precisely infer, what was being said and act accordingly. Kola was not just academically smart, he was also ever conscious of his life in the university. He did not want anything or anybody to jeopardize his career as a student, especially not now, when it was this last paper that stood between him and graduation. All the others had been a walkover. This one, too, would be. He did not like the way Salma was disturbing him. He stole a glance at the invigilator and noticed that she was not paying attention to them. He wished Salma would stop, but Salma was persistent. So Kola scribbled some coded responses to the first two questions and stealthily, surreptitiously slipped it into her hands. The lecturer did not notice this movement. As fate will have it, however, the teacher made a show of going out briefly, only to come back immediately. That moment she went out was all that Salma wanted. She opened the paper Kola slipped into her hands and furiously began deciphering the code and writing on her answer booklet. She was so deep in this unholy act that she did not notice the lecturer had come back. Now the female teacher was amused to see that Salma, who had not been writing for more than 30 minutes, had suddenly received inspiration to start writing like there was no tomorrow. She walked quietly and calmly to Salma's desk and stood behind her. For about 2 minutes, Salma was engrossed with the business at hand. She did not notice that someone was standing behind her. She was busy copying from Notes of Salvation, the euphemism they had for cheat notes. The teacher taught Scholar silently. He almost died. Then she taught Salma. Salma heard herself shouting, "What is it? What have I done? Did you see me with anything?" Meanwhile, the cheat note was still in her hands. The teacher turned to the front of the class and addressed the man in security uniform, asking him to bring the email form. "That is the examination's malpractice form," Tima said. "Yes, big mouth. Mom had told us the meaning earlier," Omar said. "I just mentioned it for some Salma-brained listeners who might have forgotten." Tima was making faces at her older brother. "I ignored them, but I was glad nonetheless to discover they were all following the story." By the time the security man brought the email form, the teacher had confiscated the cheat note from Salma. Salma was asked to fill in the form,
and Kola was to sign as witness. At this point, Kola felt an instant surge of relief since the teacher did not actually see him hand over the note to Salma. Now, exams malpractice was one offense.
Failing to fill the email form was another offense altogether.
When Salma finished her long harangue about her innocence and refused to sign, she was persuaded to sign by the security man, who assured her that no one will stop her from continuing to write her paper and that he was sure they would resolve the matter at the office of the head of department. After she signed, some calm was restored in the examination hall and the students wrote till they finished. A female student who was sitting on the other side of Salma was also asked to sign the second witness form. She did. The lecturer assured them that if Salma was lucky, the whole incident would not go beyond the HOD's office. When they were done writing the moral philosophy paper, Salma followed the teacher to the HOD's office. One thing she was not so sure about was that though she did not know who the new HOD was, students were full of praises for his goodness and compassion. She had been in the school for 4 years, and she never had any altercation with teaching staff. She did her best to avoid them. She made sure she had no relationship of any kind with any of her teachers.
Most of the friends she had amongst the academic staff were in the other faculties.
This particular HOD, her own HOD, they said he was very kind, so she was sure she would find compassion in his eyes. But the thought of what will happen if things went the other way was heart-wrenching. Salma found herself shedding tears even before anyone reprimanded her. She knew what she did was wrong, but students were doing it all over, so why should she be this unlucky? Exams malpractice at final year in the last semester and while writing the last paper. Was this a curse or something? Please, God, let this cup pass over me. The invigilator told Salma not to worry. Our HOD is a benevolent man. He is kind and loves the progress of his students. This is not the first time I take cases to him. Usually, he would admonish the students and warn them never to repeat what they did, and the matter will die there. I do not see how your case will be different.
But, madam, Salma said through her tears, you should have allowed me be. You should have ignored me. You should have just seized the paper, and the matter would have died in the class.
And I would have lost my job. You have no idea how many years I put in to get to where I am. In any case, what did you do to warrant that kind of action from me? You know the rules. With or without me, the security man would have noticed and he would have reported. No, my dear, this is the best way to handle it. Let the head of department who has authority to handle this matter handle it. Believe me, you have nothing to worry about. You will see. As they walked towards the office of the HOD, Salma was in prayers as she had never prayed before. She knew she would never be counted among the holiest people, but still she had faith. She knew particularly in this regard and where it concerned the issue of exam malpractices, she was a first offender. And even in court, first offenders were treated genially.
She resolved never to misbehave again if God gave her another chance.
University was not a life or death affair. But when you came to 400 level last semester exams, it looked like it. A life or death affair. Please, God, do not let me be rubbished like this. I have not been a very good girl, I know. But I also know you are all forgiving and merciful. Please, God, in the name of all that is holy, deliver me. Let me look at this wicked woman and laugh. I know she is laughing at me inside. Generally, I know that women don't like me, especially my lecturers. But is it my fault, God, that you made me this beautiful, this youthful? I know their problem, envy. My looks and age are killing them. Please, God, do not give them a chance to kill me too. I promise to renew my ways. I will reestablish my relationship with you. I know where I was wanting. You made us, and you made us fallible. So please, forgive our trespasses. Salma kept praying silently till they reached the office of the head of department. The last time she was there was 2 years ago when she had issues with her add and drop forms. Even then, she did not see the HOD. The secretary attended to them. In any case, even if she had seen him,
He would not have been in a position to help her since a new HOD had taken over about 6 months before the examination started. Whoever the new HOD will be, Salma prayed she will find compassion in his eyes. The secretary asked them to wait so she could tell her boss that they wanted to see him. She went in, announced their arrival, and came out. "He said you could go in, ma," the secretary addressed the invigilator. She went in after instructing Salma, Kola, and the other witness to wait. "Good morning, sir."
"Good morning, Dr. Amina. Sir, we have one case."
"Emal?"
"Yes."
"Final year?"
"Yes."
"Boy or girl?"
"Girl."
"That's rare. How bad?"
"Very bad."
"That means you caught her with the cheat notes and all?"
"Yes, sir."
"She has signed the form?"
"Yes, sir."
"And the witnesses?"
"Yes."
"Okay, let them come in."
The lecturer opened the door, stuck her head out of the door, and motioned with her head for them to come in.
They all trooped into the HOD's office. Salma was the last in tow. The lecturer closed the door after her. As they entered, he looked at the invigilating lecturer and said, with coldness in his voice, "Doctor, prepare the documents for the exams and ethics committee for further processing. I'm sure you know this is beyond me."
"Okay, sir," she said, and went out.
I can just imagine. Omar was beside himself with excitement. "Mom, this reads like a story of fiction. Honestly, if you were not the one telling us, I would have said you made it all up." I smiled at my son without saying a word. "Then what happened to Salma?" he asked. "Sadly, when she was summoned by the committee, she implicated Kolawole Abdul. He too was also expelled."
"Mom, how wicked can this girl be? You mean?"
I extended my hand and touched his shoulder. "Rules are rules, my son. If you do not want to get caught, then don't break them." Omar looked at me strangely, and I knew what the unasked question meant. "You see," I told him, "Salma knew what she was doing all along, and she did not just go down without a fight." The Life Changer, Chapter 7. When she was summoned by the Examination Malpractice and Ethics Committee, VD, a letter asking her to report to the committee in a week's time, she tried to do what every lawbreaker usually attempted to do when caught. She tried to find ways around the rules. She couldn't. The established law of EMA was so clear that most students, when caught, will simply pack their belongings and leave the school and go sit for another qualifying exams to another university. That is, they will seek admission again through JAMB to another school. Most did not even bother to honor the summons of the Examinations and Ethics Committee. They would just leave, since in the end, they knew the outcome. Most universities had zero tolerance for examination small practices. But when you were in the last semester of your final year, the desperation goes deeper than that. Leaving the school will literally have to be the last thing you would want to do. Salma therefore went and met Tomiwa and confided in her her predicament. Tomiwa was genuinely sympathetic and asked Salma what they should do under the circumstance. "I was thinking of talking to Labaran to talk to Habib, who will put a word for me in the ears of the committee chairman or the vice chancellor or someone higher up. You know, these politicians, they have their ways. They're very influential." Tomiwa nodded, knowing indeed that Salma's condition was desperate, at the same time doubting whether the strategy will work. Somebody higher up, could she be referring to the visitor to the university? That is, the president, for crying out loud? But in her situation, one would try almost anything. Desperate measures, so said the sage, required desperate remedies. Salma did as she told Tomiwa she would. Habib asked Labaran to bring her to his office. It was the first time she was there. Tomiwa herself had been to the office only a few times. As she sat on the sofa opposite him, Salma took in the magnificent office in one glance. It was simply luxurious. It was tastefully furnished and had so much space. Salma wondered what they would be doing there. Then she espied a collapsible conference table linked to the wall facing the office entrance. The name on his desk read, "Habib Lawal, Speaker." Salma heaved a sigh of relief. Habib was indeed no ordinary honorable.
He was the Speaker of the House. After the state governor and deputy governor, he was the next most influential figure in the state. And to imagine that this was the man she gave fake number to and settled for his driver. God, what kind of bad spirit was pursuing me? He sat resplendent behind the huge mahogany desk and was turning from left to right and then left again on his executive swivel chair. Salma could not help admiring the power and influence behind that desk. She reckoned, if anybody was going to get me off the hook, this guy would. He was very professional and businesslike when he said, I heard your message from Labaran, dear Salma. What exactly do you want me to do for you?
I have to graduate, sir. Sorry, Honorable. I just have to graduate. It is not just one lousy general studies course that will see me expelled from the school. No, sir. You have to do something.
I understand. You see, the only person I know who can assist us is Professor Dabo. Salma felt her stomach sink. She fought the overriding desire to rush to the toilet and empty her bladder. Why must this Professor Dabo keep appearing and reappearing in her life like a recurring decimal?
Honorable, she began and paused.
Yes?
There has to be someone else.
Like who do you have in mind? The Honorable reclined on his chair and took a long look at Salma. Then a thin, mischievous smile played across the corners of his lips. He pressed an invisible button on his desk and the entrance door automatically locked. Salma did not notice this surreptitious movement. Like the chairman of IMEC, that is the chairman of the Exams Malpractice and Ethics Committee. He's a professor of biological sciences. What makes you think he would agree to our request?
Because they said the man likes money a lot.
Chairman of the University Ethics Committee being susceptible to financial underhandedness? That's a laugh. When it comes to money, every man has his price, Salma said, laughing with him. He stood up from his chair and came to sit on the three-long sofa nearest to Salma. I like that philosophy about every man having his price, he said. But what of every woman? Ours is a given, but sometimes who is doing the pricing matters, she said meaningfully.
Like, do I matter? Habib said.
She said, if you do not lose the matter at hand, I will not. We're talking about the chairman of your committee, yes. I made my own research and people said he can sell his mother's soul.
If the price is right.
So, like, how much do you think we could offer him?
200,000, maybe 300,000.
And if I give you that amount, what do I expect in return?
When I gave you Tomiwa, what did you give me in return?
You didn't give me Tomiwa, remember? She was to be your escape route because you didn't like me. It turned out that she did not mind going out with me, so the benefit is all hers. Now the deal is different.
How different? Salma asked.
You want 200,000 or 300,000 naira. And I said, what do I get in return?
Don't be mischievous, Honorable. First, you know that the money is not for me. Secondly, you know how we are with Labaran, your friend. And thirdly, you know my relationship with Tomiwa, your girlfriend. So, if what I suspect you are asking is true, you will know that this is not proper.
We're not talking about propriety here, my dear. However else you choose to look at it, it is me who's going to lose money. I have no intention of trading arguments with you. But why would I want to give money to the chairman of the committee, you? Why would your relationship with Labaran affect what we are doing here?
Did he not himself bring you in here?
And Tomiwa, who would tell her, me or you? Salma shifted uncomfortably. She was thinking quickly. Would he really give her that kind of money? If he did, will she be stupid enough to hand over everything to the committee chairman? If she didn't, what will she have to lose? But wait, let's cross the bridge when we get to it.
I understand you, Honorable. But would you give me the money?
Sure, if you cooperate.
But your door is open, Honorable.
No, it is locked. Salma was surprised. The most interesting thing was that even after she got the money from Honorable Habib, Salma found it hard put to give it to the chairman directly. She met one of the members of the committee who introduced her to the chairman outside the school. The chairman asked her if she was guilty. She said she was guilty, but that she wanted him to temper justice with mercy. The chairman agreed and asked her to meet him at a designated rendezvous, a hotel, very far away from the school. She went there all right, but declined sleeping with him. She, however, offered to ransom herself. Just how much do you think you're worth under the circumstance?
You tell me, sir.
You know that I am not the only member of the committee. There are four other members, and their palms will also need greasing.
I know that.
And that is why I do not agree to what you were suggesting earlier. If the whole thing is cleared, we can come here again and celebrate, just the two of us. What do you think?
That is very smart of you, the chairman said enigmatically.
But you still haven't told me how much you have in mind for you and your people.
Maybe 200,000 will do, the chairman said. If I have 200,000 naira, I will use it to get admission in any of these private universities.
Salma spoke with a confidence she did not know she possessed. She knew they were in a hotel all by themselves, and the man was talking freely, not minding the risk of being secretly recorded by her. Maybe it did not matter to him one way or the other. He knew she was the one whose life was hanging on the line.
So, how much are you parting with? He asked.
I will give you 100,000, and it had better work. If it does not, I will so scream and you will not hear the last of this. Remember, you have more to lose than me when the chips are down.
No problem, but subtle threats will not help you under this circumstance. You are hardly in a position to make bargains.
I just agreed to the sum because I know you are a student who needs help.
She dipped her hand into the handbag she carried and gave him the money. He collected it, divided the bundle into two, and thrust them in his trouser pockets. Suddenly, a strange thought occurred to her and she voiced it out.
Sir, I do not even know your name.
He laughed. Of what use will my name be to you?
If you are not divulging your name, then we might as well...
Okay. Dr. Kabir. Muhammad Kabir. Okay, I will believe in now.
Be seeing you, he said, and opened his arms for a hug. She declined and offered her hand for a handshake instead. Thereafter, she walked calmly out of the hotel and went home. When she was called to defend herself before the committee, she was first shocked to see that the person seated on the chair, facing her, was not the person to whom she had given the money in the hotel. Dr. Kabir was not a member of the committee. This was not possible. She looked again, peering closely, and without shame at each member of the committee. Still, she could not see him. She did not start crying until she discovered that the man whom she hardly knew, who claims to also be a member of the committee who introduced her to Dr. Kabir, was also not there.
I have been duped, she told herself, and began to cry.
The man who was at the helm of affairs and other members of the committee mistook her tears for remorse and perhaps repentance. They advised her to calm down and narrate what transpired at the examination hall that day. She calmed herself down and told them the whole story. In the heat of her agitation, she did not know when she told them that she actually received the cheat notes from Kolawole Abdul.
And who is Kolawole Abdul? A member of the committee asked.
He is my classmate.
Is that all? Just a classmate?
And he will risk his academic career, discounting the possibility of rustication, for just a classmate?
Salma's stomach sank. In fact, she did not know the implication of dropping Kolawole's name. Why did she make a slip like that? She pestered the boy to help her the way he pestered her to go out with him, and she declined, saying she preferred they remained good friends. He had agreed and kept his word and distance. In the end, however, she gave in because he was giving her private tutorials, and he was the brightest. But for him to risk his academic life for her, and this was the way she was repaying him, it was not fair. It simply was not fair. It was also not fair what men were doing to her. No man ever treated her for her essence.
They all related to her based on her looks, and all they ever seemed to want from her was dating her. That included Kolaoli. She mentally ran the whole gamut of the men she knew in her life and came to the conclusion that except for her father, no man, indeed, no man was worthy of being called a man. So to hell with Kolaoli and Habib and Labaran, Dr. Kabir and all the others who claimed they were helping her by exploiting her. Ha ha ha, she laughed inwardly. And Dr. Kabir was going to pay. He was the one who took money from her. Instinctively, she knew now that she was not going to escape. She was going to be expelled. She knew that. Miss Salma, the chairman prompted when he saw that she was lost in her unpleasant reverie. Yes, sir. Are you telling the committee that this Kolaoli of a fellow who supplied the notes to you just did it because you are classmates?
Yes, sir.
You have to tell the committee the truth. We do not believe anyone can be that stupid. Just tell us the truth. Your secret is safe with us.
Sir, with all due respect, I do not see the relevance of your prying into my personal life.
This is an exam malpractice committee. It's not the student disciplinary committee. Moreover, I do not see how my relationship with him, one way or the other, has any bearing on this case. There was total silence among members of the committee. This was unbelievable. How can a girl be this cheeky? Perhaps she had something up her sleeve.
We know that, the chairman said, his voice faltering in spite of himself. All we wanted to establish was that there was no monetary motive behind what happened. Students have been known to collect or give money for academic collusion.
I didn't give anybody any money.
Okay, can we have his number?
Yes, Salma said and gave out the number.
We're very sure you know the implication of what you did.
What did I do again? Salma raised her brow in affected innocence.
I mean, you know the implication of examination malpractice.
Yes, I do.
Well, that is about all for now. You may go.
Salma hesitated. You will hear from us, the chairman said.
Salma walked out solemnly, though she managed to walk out with a gait of desperate dignity.
Mom, what does she mean by saying Dr. Kabir will pay for it?
I looked at Omar and smiled.
The Life Changer, Chapter 8. Muhammad Kabir was not a medical doctor. In fact, he did not even hold a PhD. But almost everyone who knew him addressed him as Doctor. It was a nickname he had since he was in secondary school, and it stuck. When he was employed as an LT, a laboratory technologist in the university, almost everyone was calling him Doctor. When his HOD asked him his proper name, he said it was Muhammad Kabir. I'm pleased to meet you, Dr. Kabir. The HOD extended his hand for a handshake. And since then, he became Dr. Kabir to all. And when he wore his oversized lab coat, the very similitude with a genuine doctor was uncanny. He was a very friendly and intrusive sort of person. He had a way with people that before you knew, he would come real close to you. He was virtually on intimate terms with almost anyone who mattered in the school. This ranged from the vice chancellor, the faculty deans, down to the heads of department. Kabir's friendliness cut across religion and tribe. Everyone was his friend, male or female. The only blemish he had on his character was that he had weakness for easy money, and most of his colleagues did not know this, so it never bothered them. It was true that Kabir was friendly, but he was also almost always moody. His state of permanent impecuniosity attested to this. In the school, people could not explain this oxymoron of someone being moody and cheerful at the same time. Most of them, however, were never close enough to him to know of his financial affairs. Rumor had it that, no matter how much money he had, he would always lose it at the cards. He was more of a compulsive gambler than a habitual one.
since the money was not regular in coming. Consequently, he was reclusive, but whenever he encountered anyone, he affected this visor of permanent cheerfulness largely, perhaps to mask off his real feelings for being alone and destitute. By the time Labaran finished supplying this information to Habib, it was all Habib could do to stop himself from laughing out loud. "You are telling me that the person who duped your girlfriend was a common lab attendant?" "It looks like it, Honorable." "And a common gambler?" "Yes, sir." "How did you get all this information about him then?" "When Salma left the committee and came to me crying for justice, I said you were the only person who could help us. So through our campus pimp, I traced and found the person who gave Salma Kabir's name. We gave him a little working over and threatened to expose him to the school authority for the racket, or is it syndicate they are superintending in the university?" He opened up and sang like a canary. "So how do you intend to deal with the matter?" "Zaki, of course." Honorable Habib was quiet for a long while. He was not comfortable with Zaki at all. The last time he was instructed to deal with Alhaji Adamu by kidnapping his son, he bungled it. He had to involve the services of one inexperienced villager, and together they got themselves arrested. It was to his credit that he did not divulge my name. That blunder cost me over ¼ million naira. It was not so much to secure their release as it was to protect my name. The police were asking for over ₦1 million to kill the matter. Luckily, my position helped. I remember distinctly that the village shamus, who was his name, Tali, I think, had to be instructed to go and settle in a remote village, not better than the Lafayette he loved so much, but no worse. The police ensured that he was physically taken there, and they made him promise never to set foot on Lafayette soil again. He gave his word after they threatened to open the case of kidnapping against him any time he was even rumored to be seen in Lafayette. Tali had assured them that he would never visit his village again and vowed never to have anything to do with anyone that he did not know before. I heard that he went about telling people that he was a successful farmer in his new village that lay somewhere between Nigeria and Niger. The actual story that filtered out was that he was into smuggling. I did not know and really did not much care. I was more concerned with Zaki. He may never be straightforward, but he had his day. He was visibly involved with business of importing and exporting spare parts of cars, but once in a while, he would rent out his brawn for additional income, and he never bothered to find out the legality or otherwise of this additional income. Labaran was right. We needed Zaki. Omar was looking strangely at me. I noticed also that Jamila, Tima, and even Bint had their eyes transfixed on me in total surprise. Even disbelief. They wanted more details, perhaps. But the immediacy of the story took care of the moment if they wanted. They could ask whatever clarification they required after I was done with my tale. So I resumed. So, Zaki was contacted, and he trailed Kabir to one of his regular gambling joints. Zaki waited in the suffocating and densely smoky gambling hall till it was late in the night when they were almost done with their dealings. He entertained himself by mentally running over in his mind the chorus he knew offhand from the song of the late Kenny Rogers, The Gambler. "You gotta know when to hold them, know when to fold them. Know when to walk away and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done." Maybe Kabir was aware of the song. Maybe he was not. What was instructive was that by some indirect telepathic instigation, after the time he cleared a major win, contrary to the expectations of all gamblers, including himself, he said he had had enough for the night. He came to the arena with less than 50,000 naira, and now he was 300,000 naira richer. To the consternation and chagrin of those who respect the cards more than their god, they watched solemnly as Kabir stood up to go. This was simply against the norm. No gambler worthy of the name left the table after winning.
They were often known to leave after losing or when the game was off. The Katagi, that is the leader of the gambling group, reputed to be inconsiderate, tough, and definitely merciless, winked surreptitiously at a thug seated opposite him to correct this anomaly. The anomaly of a gambler leaving the table after winning when the game was still on. The thug nodded, stood up, and began following Kabir at a safe distance. But the distance was not safe enough. For Zaki also was following Kabir, though the thug was between them and unaware of this fact. At the time, though, Zaki himself did not know that the thug was following Kabir. It was after a series of turns that brought them to an unlit alley that Zaki believes that someone else was following his prey. This confirms two things. Kabir did not have as many friends in the gambling arena as he did in school, and secondly, he must have won plenty of money this night to warrant his being followed. Before he could make a turn to the brighter side of town, the thug hurried up and tackled Kabir from behind, making him fall. The thug was not even hooded, but Kabir did not have time to immediately recognize or identify who fell him. Before he could make sense of what was happening, he felt the weight of another man on top of them. The three of them sprawled on the floor, fighting and kicking at one another. The thug was more shocked because he did not believe that his boss will send another thug after him. That meant Katagi did not trust him. "I will show that bastard once I get free from this." While this was going on, Kabir had a good look at the thug and shouted, "Kumuzu! You mean this is how you guys operate? I've never won anything as substantial as this in my entire life, and now you can't even allow me to keep it. Is it you or Katagi?" "It is your mother," Zaki said as he landed Kabir a deafening blow. Gumuzu saw that he was no match for Zaki and attempted to back off. He almost succeeded, but Zaki gave him a heavy karate kick that landed in the groin. This made Gumuzu to yelp and scream out aloud. He doubled up in pain and held his groin with his two hands. He remained in that position for a few seconds more, and when the pain receded somewhat, and at the slightest sight of escape opportunity, he ran down the alley and disappeared into the darkness. Zaki now had his hands around Kabir's neck, trying to choke him. When he was certain Kabir got the message, he eased up the pressure and asked, "Where is the money?"
"Here, here, it's in my inner pocket. Please don't kill me. Tell Katagi I would never set my foot in the gambling hall again. I thought they were straight people, good people. I did not know that all of them are crooks. All gamblers are cheats."
"And what are you?" Zaki said sarcastically as he slowly retrieves the money from Kabir's pocket.
"I am a decent employee of the university." Zaki slapped him hard across his face and spat.
"Indeed. And do you know one Salma?" Kabir sat up froggily, feeling the pain all over his body. He only heard the question faintly. "Salma?" he repeated uncertainly. Zaki kicked him by the side again and said,
"You heard me the first time."
"Yes, yes, I know her."
"Well then, this is for her, for the money you collected from her, for lying to her and for coming to gamble with her money. And indeed, for all the girls you have been deceiving by impersonating one officer of the university or another. She has a tape of your conversation, and we're going to make it available to the school authority at the appropriate time." "This," he kicked him hard again, "is a message from Katagi. He said, if this is the kind of gambler you are, then you are not fit to be called one. He warned that you should be careful when next you meet him or any of his boys." He kicked him again. "That is my comeuppance."
Strangely, that was what Kabir heard in his head before he passed out. Zaki took the money to Labaran. By the time Labaran counted the money and saw there was 300,000 naira, he counted 50,000 and gave to Zaki and held on to the rest. He had no intention of handing the money over to Habib. This was not betrayal, he reckoned. He justified his act by giving himself three reasons why the money must not go to Honorable Habib. In the first place, Habib was the Speaker of the House and therefore did not need such a paltry sum as 300,000 naira. Secondly, he reasoned that Habib was in no position to know how much he took from Kabir or if he collected anything at all.
because as a perpetual gambler, no one will expect Kabir to even have a cover on him. Thirdly, and more disturbingly, Labaran was sure that Habib did not give the money to Salma just like that. It was a payment for some service rendered, which service all of them were well too aware of. No, it did not amount to betrayal what he was doing. If it must be categorized, then this act of non-remittal will simply appear like a leveling up. After all, he was all prepared not to think about what must have transpired between Salma and Habib as betrayal. It was simply convenience, and this was certainly convenience to him. At this point, I paused in my narration and asked for a refill of my Zobo drink. Omar seemed to have a million and one questions to ask, but he restrained himself. "Is there anything you want to ask, my dear?" I asked him directly. "Mom, I just want to know how Honorable Habib ended up. I would give anything to know how he ended up myself." But Salma did not say. "There's simply no justice on this earth." I did not quickly agree with my son, but I know he was right. It was not in me as a mother to underscore his feeling of despondency over the affairs of the world, or indeed his disenchantment with the social setup as a whole. But he was right. Justice was ice. Just ice. Frozen. Perhaps never to thaw until those who matter decided to make it thaw. But there is always justice in the hereafter, my son. The journey to the hereafter is rather long and tedious, Mom. And frankly, I'm not in a hurry to go there. "Go where?" Bint asked him. "The hereafter," he replied without thinking. "I don't want to go there either." Bint was not sure what he was talking about, but she believed if her brother said he was not in a hurry to go to any place, then it would be wise for anyone who had sense to delay going to that place as long as possible. That reminds me of the incident that happened when Salma lost her father while she was in the university. "What happened, Mom?" Tima asked. On the eighth day after the funeral, Salma came to the hostel all the worse for wear. She was really looking haggard. It became obvious to anyone who cared to observe that the girl was in mourning. Her friends and roommates, Ngozi, Ada, and Tomiwa, had collectively gone to commiserate with her for her loss. So when she got back, they saw that she was really down physically and spiritually. They still commiserated with her further. Ngozi, however, could not resist asking her the all-important question that had been at the back of her mind since the death took place. "Why are you people always in a hurry to bury your dead?" Salma did not answer. Tomiwa, however, picked up the gauntlet. "What precisely do you mean by that?" "Take it easy, my dear. I just meant to observe that you people seem eager to bury your people as soon as they are pronounced dead." Tomiwa was sitting on top of the bed at the upper bunk. She now jumped down when she heard this. She sat near Salma while she addressed Ngozi. "There are three things wrong with your observation. The first is that we do not bury people. We bury corpses. As soon as a person is pronounced dead, his personality automatically ceases with his last expiry of breath. The second thing is we are not eager to bury our dead. We were anxious for them to get well when they were ill. But the moment they die, our anxiety ends and their own begins as creatures bound for a rendezvous with their creator. We do not want to delay the meeting. Moreover, we are religiously enjoined to hasten their funeral, since the more the delay, the more anguish that will be unleashed on the family of the bereaved. And thirdly, when you look at it objectively, funeral delay does not have advantages on anyone. It does not help the dead. The body will begin to decompose after a while, and it does not matter how well you think you have preserved it. It does not help the bereaved either, who are made to grieve several times over." "What exactly do you mean, Tommy? You cannot be serious," Ngozi said, her tone uncertain. "You mean someone dies and you rush to bury him like he was a nobody? Like he was a nobody? No last rites?
no lying in state, no waiting for his children and relations to come and bid him final farewell? If the children are around when he dies, fine. Nothing stops them from praying for him there and then and forever thereafter.
Forever thereafter?
Yes, Ngozi. Children pray for their parents and the Lord God will hear their prayers and take pity on the soul of the dead. For us, all good deeds and bad ones for that matter cease with the seizure of breath. So you do not pray for the dead? No, Ngozi said, with needless emphasis. Such prayers are like medicine after death, ineffectual. So what does RIP mean?
What?
You heard me the first time. What does RIP mean? It means rest in peace. Ngozi was not sure where the question was leading to.
Who or what should rest in peace?
The soul of the departed. I thought you said you do not pray for the dead.
We are not praying for the dead. We are praying for the repose of his soul.
Whose soul?
The dead.
At this juncture, even Ngozi herself was not too convinced again. So, tell me, Tomiwa said, why do you delay burials?
First, to make sure that we are not burying our relations alive.
And where do you keep them to ensure that they are alive?
The morgue?
Ngozi ignored this remark and let drop what she considered her trump card. The more we delay the funeral, the more we allow people, friends and relations who are living far away to come and pay their last respects, so that they will not be tormented after the body is interred.
I think differently, Angie. I think family and friends are tormented three times over. First, when the death itself occurs. Second, when the body leaves for the mortuary. And third, on the day of the burial. It kind of stretches the level of torment and the length of sadness.
But it is our culture.
Yeah, a very expensive one at that.
And we're not complaining, Tommy.
I understand, and neither are we, Angie. You bury your dead with so much fanfare after a long period, and we bury ours with solemnity as soon as the person is confirmed dead. It does not mean that either of us love their dead less. As they were going on with this discussion, they heard a whimper, and as one, they looked at Salma, who had been crying all along.
We are sorry, Sally. How insensitive of us. Ada went and held her by the shoulder, like someone trying to rock a child to sleep. They all gathered around her quietly. That was how they slept that day, quietly, sadly. Those four people were more like sisters than roommates, till they left the school.
Mom, this is a very interesting story. If you remove the dying bits, I love how the girls relate with one another. It's really interesting. Omar was beside himself.
Why wouldn't it be interesting, Tima said. Since it's all about girls.
Mom, I hope you're listening to your daughter. Someone is going to lose her teeth in this house. And someone will not get their smartphone in this house.
Tima ensured that she came to sit beside me as she said this.
What do you mean by that, Tima?
Nothing. When Daddy comes back, I will make sure I rush to him and tell him first about the admission. The phone he promised to buy for you and what you intend to do with it.
And what?
Omar said, gritting his teeth in a maniacal sort of way.
Did I say I intend to do with it?
Pursue girls in the campus, Tima said simply. Omar looked beseechingly at me in a comical sort of way that made me to believe if I did not do something quickly, he would either insult his sister or leave the house. The mood was still cheerful, and I did not want anything to spoil it. So I said, like all other advancement in technology, there are advantages in owning a smartphone, and there are also disadvantages. It all depends on how you use it. Salma had a boyfriend named Salim, who had a sour experience with smartphone. After she lost her father, Salma decided to change her ways. She became decent and very serious. When Salim talked to her, he told her straight up that he wanted to marry her, and the courtship began. When I saw the level of her seriousness and commitment, that was when I allowed her into my life, and I was always admonishing her on how to conduct herself. One day, I observed that she was no longer chatting as frequently as she was used to doing on her flashy phone, and I asked why. She told me that Salim, her fiancé, had a very nasty experience on account of chatting, and that experience settled her once and for all to become a changed person. The Life Changer, Chapter 9.
It was not too long ago that Salim bought his first smartphone. It was the Samsung brand, and it had this wide screen that responded to a stylus touch, as well as the fingers of the owner. They called it the Note series. It was really unique, and he was so proud of it. Of course, it was expensive. But for someone whose marriage had not been fixed, even Salma herself encouraged him to enjoy his money before marriage responsibilities ensnared him. He hearkened to her advice, and he said he was going to use the phone. He discovered several dating sites and loaded the applications. In the beginning, Salma was not aware of this. The social media was awash with many of these chat rooms, and all one needed to do was to download the application of a particular chat group, and one will be linked up to whoever one desired. Salim was into all conceivable instant and distant relationship social outlets. I think they still abound. He was on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, Badoo, Tugo, WeChat, all these plus so many others that Salma could not remember their names. He told her all this after his nasty experience. One day, Salim had gone to his friend, Lawal, all excited, and told him he had a new girlfriend. Lawal was sitting in the living room watching his inevitable wrestling program. He muted the sound from the remote control in his hand to better listen to his friend. Salim, I don't know what is wrong with you. You have Salma as fiancé, and now you are talking about a girlfriend. What kind of life is this? Point of correction, my friend. Salma is technically my wife. We're just waiting for the day to be fixed. But you know, man must be allowed some moment of unchecked rascality before becoming another woman's personal property or slave. I guess you found yet another girl that seems to catch your fancy. Where did you meet her? She must be a quintessential beauty for you to go on about her like this. Have I met her before? My friend, stop joking. You have not met her before, but you will now. See, come and have a look. Salim brought out his phone and showed a particular picture to Lawal. You did not tell me you now like Indian women, Lawal said. You see, she's that beautiful. She's not Indian. She said she is Fulani. When did you see her? Salim hesitated and shrugged. I did not really meet her physically, but we have been chatting for over 1 week now. And you are convinced that she is who she has claimed to be?
Sure. Why should I doubt that?
Why not? She gave me her phone number and I gave her mine. And by God, she has such a beautiful voice. Voice befitting a princess.
Princess?
Yes. And how does the voice of a princess sound? Look here, my friend. Are you accompanying me to see her or not?
Me. To accompany you to see a person you have never met before. And yet you want to make your girlfriend.
What do I tell Salma?
No. Go and see her first. Subsequently, we can go together.
Salim looked at Lawal like he was going to strangle him. But suddenly he saw the wisdom in what his friend said. What if they went and on seeing her, she turned out different from what they thought? Or worse, what if she saw him in real life and decided she did not like what she saw? That could really be embarrassing if your friend was with you. He went ahead to see his social media princess, with whom he had been chatting for over a week without seeing each other. When he came back a few hours later, he met Lawal seated where he left him several hours before. He was watching a different film this time around.
Mr. Romeo is back, or do I call you Casanova? How did it go, man? How is our Indian princess?
Hell, my friend. Are you clairvoyant?
No, what happened?
My princess turned out to be a hideously unpresentable creature.
Her face. Oh my God, you were right.
It was someone else's picture she used as her DP, her displayed picture, and that was how I was deceived.
Lawal began laughing uproariously.
My friend, what is funny here? Salim said when Lawal would not stop laughing.
I thought we were supposed to be talking about your new girlfriend, not about how our princess looks. He laughed some more and proceeded to tell Salim some home truth about meeting a girl on the social media.
You're lucky, he said. She even agrees to meet you. In other instances, she will so chat you up leeringly, invitingly, making false promises until she gets you to really fall for her. Then she will start making demands. The demands begin from something as menial as a recharge card for her phone. Then gradually, you graduate into sending money into her account,
because she would have claimed to be in another city and she wanted to come visiting, or she would kill her relations and ask you to send funeral money. In another situation, she can even send you on a wild goose chase if you're that gullible. She may be just your next door neighbor, and since she knows that you do not know her, she may claim to be from Kano or Sokoto and ask you to come visiting. If you're stupid enough to go visiting, you will be shocked that by the time you would have traveled that long distance and called her, she will say she was not around, or she had taken ill, or some such nonsense. Or indeed, she would just refuse to pick your call. Or if you persist, she will just switch off her phone. The other extreme, and this one is really funny, is when you befriend a lady based on the picture displayed, and she turned out to be a man. Here, all you need to expect is extortion. And in this time, when kidnapping has become so rampant and unchecked, you need to be careful. They may well take you and ask for ransom, which nobody can pay. Lawal paused his admonition and looked at Salim, who seemed to be lost in his thought. "What is wrong, man?" he asked. "There is something I have not disclosed to you before. It is something you have said just now about kidnapping. I have a genuine cause to thank God." "We all do, my friend. We all do." "No, you do not understand. This, my ugly princess, was not the first case I went visiting. Maybe you did not wonder why I insisted you should follow me to see her for the first time, and why I insisted on seeing her in the afternoon."
"No, I did not bother to think about that."
"Well, there was an antecedent. As I said, she was not the first. I was so ashamed to tell you about this experience that happened about a month ago. At that time, it was frightening. Later, when I was free, it became disgraceful for me to even talk about it. But now that you seem to know all about social media relationships, I can tell you about Natasha."
"Natasha?"
"Yes, Natasha. She lives in the university town near Lafayette. I do not know for sure whether she is a bona fide student or is just claiming to be one. You know, one thing with this social media, it appears more untruth are being aired unchecked than factual stories. In any case, Natasha sent me a friend request and I accepted. Then we started chatting. As I was going through the pictures she uploaded, I was convinced that she was the one because the pictures were many and they all looked like her. What should have been worrisome to me was ironically what intrigued me, and I wanted to get to know her more closely. More than half of the pictures were semi-nude and extremely attractive. And she had such seductive language that breaks down any man's wall of resistance. When you add the deliberately sexy language with the sexier pictures, you have a recipe for disaster which few men could resist. So when she invited me to come visiting, I did not hesitate. She describes their house to me, which she said was at the back of the school. However, she said she will not be allowed to come out in the afternoon. She insisted that I should come between 8 and 9 in the evening. In the night, actually. When I set off to visit, I called her as I approached the school. She answered at once and was giving me directions on how to reach the location with ease. I could have sworn I heard male voices in the background. But I did not give much thought to that. I drove my car slowly down the alley, she described. Anytime my mind told me to reconsider my decision and go back, I would look at her half-naked pictures and the devil will win. I followed the description till I came to a place where there was very little illumination.
And she asked me to stop there. I turned on my full light and saw that the place was actually a cul-de-sac.
Characteristically, you know, I always parked my car military-style fashion. This simply means that whenever I reached my destination and my route back entailed turning and going the way I came, I will do this maneuver and park my car facing the direction I will go when leaving. That way, I did not have to waste time. I will just enter and drive off. That parking is called military parking in Nigerian parlance. So I maneuvered the car to face where I was coming from. Even as I was trying to turn, she called to find out if I was leaving. I said I was just parking. And Natasha came out. She was even more beautiful than she appeared in her pictures. And she sure looked inviting. She was highly endowed and she had no qualms about flaunting those endowments. It was all I could do to look away from her exposed cleavage. The moon was playing pranks with my sight, for she looked infinitely more alluring than I thought she was going to be in real life. I motioned her to come in. She declined and said she was going to be just fine standing by my side. I was in my father's SUV, that sport utility vehicle which everyone called Jeep around here. It was all well with me because from where she stood, I was afforded a better view of her frontal display. I was drooling over this when I heard the passenger door of my car open. I turned to see a very hefty stranger pointing a gun at me. The shock was so great that I did not hear when the second person entered my car from behind. I was petrified with fear.
"Do not say a word," the man with a gun said. "Just hand over the car keys and come to the back seat. Don't even bother removing the key. Leave it in the ignition." I moved to the back seat. "And you, Ashao," he addressed Natasha, "join your husband at the back."
Natasha followed, her body shaking as she was whispering, "Please don't hurt him. And you, my dear, give them whatever they want. Please do not shoot us." Of course, I noticed the self-distancing in her first sentence, "Don't hurt him." My eyes instantly cleared. I knew instantly that she was part of the conspiracy. She was the bait used to lure susceptible men into dark alleys. But my realization helped me nothing, since I was held at the point of a gun. The only thing I could say was, "From God we came, and unto him is our returning." This is the standard prayer in the face of any calamity. I kept reciting that till the man with the gun shouted at me to stop, or he would waste me. I was shivering from head to foot, but they did not notice. The man's vocabulary seemed to consist of only one word, waste. I was instinctively beginning to have a wasteful idea myself. He instructed his companion, whom he addressed as Roger, to start the car. Strangely enough, the car would not start. He did his best, but the car would not start. They did all they could, but the car would not budge. Obviously, it was the car they wanted. But I was also sure they would not hesitate to shoot me if I gave them the slightest opportunity. When the car refused to peak after the third attempt, I was asked to start it. I was bemused to see that when I sat behind the driving wheel, I touched the gear lever and discovered that it was still engaged. Since the car was an automatic transmission, the ignition will not pick so long as the gear is engaged. But I was still rattled, thinking for a way out without getting myself killed. Meanwhile, the robber with the gun kept threatening me to start the car or he would splash my brains across the dashboard and the windshield. I returned the lever to park and turned on the ignition. The car started. Then I was ordered to come back to the back seat while the other fellow drove. He went and sat behind the wheel and attempted to engage gear. Again, the gear lever proved uncooperative. Tried as he could, the car would not move. "Let his lover boy drive the car himself to the office." I did not know what they were talking about. But from the moment I once again sat behind the wheel, there was only one thought: escape or death. I started driving slowly. Then when I came near another turn, which they said led to their office, and instructed me to take that turn, I ignored them. The man with the gun kept threatening he would waste me if I did not turn. Impulsively, I decided to waste all of us in the car. I pressed hard on the accelerator pedal, and the car gathered momentum and flew ahead. I did not stop till I came to an intersection about 300 meters later. My stopping was not born out of any rational decision to obey traffic regulation. Indeed, at that moment when I neared the intersection, I did not know whether I was the one on the narrow road linking to the major road or vice versa. The very self-preservation instinct that made me to drive at such a breakneck speed with the robbers inside the car was the same impulsive decision that made me to pause and look if there was a vehicle coming from my either side. I swerved to the right when I saw that the only vehicle coming was from my left. As I swerved, my right front wheel got momentarily stuck in the mud, but I accelerated and it became unstuck. While this was going on, I looked to my right and discovered that the man wielding the gun earlier had disappeared from the vehicle. I turned around. There was nobody at the back seat either.
Roger and Natasha seemed to have disappeared into thin air. Thereafter, I drove steadily, but my heart was palpitating till I reached home. What happened to them? To God who made me, I do not know. My guess is they must have jumped out and disappeared into the darkness, no doubt after sustaining bruises. The thought of going to the police crossed my mind the next day, but I said, to hell with it. Since I was alive and healthy, why would I add police wahala to my life? No. I said, let them go. One day will come when they will be caught in their shady and wicked game. Lawal looked at Salim and said, you are really a wonderful guy. Why? Because I did not tell anyone? No. Because you still had the heart to engage another Facebook friend in another chat. You mean my ugly princess? Don't worry. It won't happen again. And it never happened again. Shortly after that incident, which he narrated to Lawal, Salim got engaged to Salma. Tima turned a chair and looked at Omar. So, Mr. Smartphone, you've heard what you're getting yourself into. Even older people who had more sense than you escaped the evil of social media by the skin of their teeth. What guarantee do you have that you will be good? Mom, Omar, I do not have anything against your phone. You deserve it. Just be careful about the negative effect of the social media. I will, Mom. I will. So, would you tell Tima not to be in a hurry to tell Dad? I have a better idea, I said. What is it, Mommy? All the girls asked as in a chorus. We will tell Daddy together. We sit here and wait for him to come back. And as soon as he enters, we will all jump and let the news come out loudly that Omar has got admission. That way, he will be so excited. Whatever you ask, you will get. That is superb. You really know your man, the girl said, all excited already. We will wait for Daddy, I said. So, we all remained seated there under the tree, waiting for Daddy.